It's supposed to be that if you see this wild hunt, something bad is going to happen.
And the writer and comedian Stuart Lee.
I'm very glad that I had that experience, but I don't believe it happened.
Uncanny on BBC Sounds and Radio 4, beginning this Tuesday night at 11.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 27th of October. This is Alan Smith. Good morning. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says she will deliver a budget for the strivers this week. Writing in The Sun on Sunday, Ms Reeves says she will take an iron grip on the country's finances, but ensure Britain's working people are better off. The Conservatives say the budget is shaping up to be a nightmare for the British public. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Rachel Reeves is blunt. Not everything is going to be easy, she writes. The Chancellor is preparing to raise the amount businesses pay in employer national insurance contributions. That's despite allegations from Conservatives it breaks Labour's manifesto promise not to increase taxes on working people. Ms Reeves denies that, saying it will be a budget for the strivers, and insists her decisions on tax will be tough but fair. Ms Reeves is also to change how debt is measured to allow more borrowing for infrastructure projects. There are warnings that could keep interest rates higher and mortgages more expensive. But as well as releasing more money for housing, schools and energy projects, the government is expected to announce in the coming days some of that extra spending will be used for a programme to rebuild hospitals.
The Chancellor's spending commitments will include a pledge to rebuild or refurbish 50 schools in England every year. More details from our education correspondent, Hazel Shearing.
Rachel Reeves has promised £1.4 billion for the school rebuilding programme. The scheme, announced 4 years ago, aims to rebuild or refurbish about 500 schools in a decade. The BBC recently revealed that 23 schools have been completed and targets for hiring builders have been missed. The Treasury said the money represented a £550 million increase that would ramp up progress. But a teaching union said there was still a shortfall in funding for school buildings. The Chancellor also said she would triple spending on free breakfast clubs for primary school pupils and has committed to spending £1.8 billion on the expansion of free childcare hours.
BBC News understands military families will be given extra support so that they're not affected by the government's decision to impose VAT on private school fees. Children with parents in the armed forces sometimes attend boarding schools to avoid disruption to their learning if there's an overseas posting. The money will be given to families via an existing scheme. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the United States did not dictate which sites could be attacked in Iran. Scores of Israeli jets carried out three rounds of strikes on Iran on Friday night. Mr. Netanyahu said the targets were chosen in line with Israel's national interests. Our Middle East regional editor Sebastian Usher is in Jerusalem.
The consequences of Israel's retaliatory attack on Iran are likely to depend on how much damage the airstrikes did to vital elements of Iran's military capability. But the fact that they don't appear to have been aimed at Iran's economic infrastructure or its nuclear facilities has potentially lessened the imperative Tehran may feel to further raise the stakes in the showdown with Israel. But the implication that Israel yielded to American pressure on the choice of its target seems to have rankled the Israeli Prime Minister. Mr. Netanyahu has not yet given a public address since the attack on Iran, but his office moved quickly not only to insist that Israel's choice of targets was entirely its own decision, but also to dismiss a media report that it had given Iran advance notice of the attack.
The King is to return to a normal schedule of engagements next year after coping well with his tour of Australia and Samoa. A royal aide said the trip had been the perfect tonic for the King as he continued his cancer treatment. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
The tour of Australia and Samoa was the King's biggest test since his cancer diagnosis. Those working closely with him said the visit had lifted his spirits, mood and recovery. Although the King's cancer treatment is ongoing, a senior royal official said a full overseas tour programme was being planned for next year, as well as public engagements in the UK. The royal aide said the King was a great believer in mind, body and soul, that his sense of duty kept his mind and soul engaged, while doctors made sure his body was properly looked after. The King was said to have been completely unruffled by the protests in Canberra, believing free speech to be the cornerstone of democracy.
People across Japan are voting in parliamentary elections. Opinion polls suggest the Liberal Democratic Party and its junior coalition partner risk falling short of a majority. The LDP has governed Japan for almost all of the past seven decades, but its support is under threat because of concern among voters about issues including rising prices and a corruption scandal. And just a reminder that the clocks went back 1 hour overnight, marking the end of British summertime. BBC News.
On BBC iPlayer.
A cop who smashes car into a guy trying to save the planet.
Allegedly.
I don't think we should touch this.
Calderwood identified me before he died.
Starring Adil Akhtar and Michael Socca.
You don't know the whole story, then.
I'm going to declare this a critical incident now.
They're charging him with murder.
He likes to think he's controlling things and he's a show-off.
The new series of Show Trial.
This is something else I feel I should mention.
You enjoying this?
Watch all episodes on BBC iPlayer.
This is BBC Radio 4. It's that time of year. Halloween is fast approaching and in half an hour we'll be visiting a Staffordshire farm where pumpkin picking is in full swing. Meanwhile, a new reservoir there is under construction, which once complete will help keep the farm's thirsty vegetables supplied with water, especially important in a time of climate change. Kaz Graham will be our guide for On Your Farm at 6:35. First on Radio 4, here's Laurie Taylor with Thinking Aloud.
Hello. In my late teens, I had a job as a child librarian. It meant that I spent most of my working life date-stamping copies of books by Enid Blyton, Five on Treasure Island, Five Get Into Trouble, or apologising to eager 11- and 12-year-olds because there were no Blytons left in stock. Not very meaningful work. But my boss, the senior librarian, soon suggested a way in which my job could become, well, more worthwhile. You must recommend other books to those who are always asking for Blyton. Suggest Arthur Ransom and Eleanor M. Brent Dyer. That'll bring some extra meaning to your job and to the children's lives. Well, I remembered this injunction as I was reading a paper in the Journal of Human Resources entitled Experiencing Meaningful Work Through Worthwhile Contributions. And its author, who now joins me, is Katie Bailey, Emerita Professor of Work and Employment at King's College London. Katie, your research explores why people find their work meaningful, but of course my first question has to be, I mean, how are you defining this term meaningful?
Well, meaningful work tends to refer to work that the individual regards as personally significant, valuable and worthwhile. So it's about the sense that we think our work matters and makes a difference. But of course, there's been research on meaningful work from numerous different discipline areas, as psychology, sociology, theology, anthropology, ethics and so on. So if we take perhaps two of those, psychology and sociology. So what psychologists are typically interested in is meaningful work as an attitude that we might have towards our work, job satisfaction or engagement. And the kind of questions that psychologists are interested in answering is what are the factors that drive up levels of meaningful work and what happens when we find our work meaningful? Do we perform better, perhaps? Are we more motivated? Sociologists, on the other hand, are much more interested in looking at meaningful work within the context within which it arises. Questions like what work does society regard as meaningful and how does that then affect the individual? And in our paper, what we've tried to do is to bring these two perspectives together.
You undertook an analysis of accounts which were related by nurses, creative artists and lawyers, in which they explained why they found their work meaningful. Why did you choose those three occupations?
Those three occupations represented a very interesting opportunity to look at how people in very diverse roles regard their work as meaningful or conversely as meaningless.
Let's start with the nurses. What did they tell you about the meaning that they found in their choice of career?
I think it's worth just spending a moment just thinking about one of the things that we really wanted to look at in this paper, which is not just what they say about their work, but how they say it. And this led us down the route of doing what's called a critical discourse analysis. So in other words, looking at the characteristics of the kind of stories that people tell. People will narrate short stories about times when they found their work meaningful, and they have things like a plot, they have characters, they have a narrative arc that makes it very interesting to look at and try and work out well, what does this story tell us? So Sean, one of the nurses we spoke to, she narrated an incident that had arisen when a young woman, a 16-year-old girl who was deaf, came in for an appointment with her mother. And when they got there, they realised that the mother was also deaf and the doctor was going to cancel the appointment because they hadn't booked an interpreter. So Sean said, I was literally hitting my head against a brick wall. You know, everybody wanted the appointment to go ahead, but nobody knew how this had happened. We didn't know what to do. She said, so I got out a pen and paper and I got them to write down their questions and the doctor could answer, and so the appointment could go ahead. So here we have an interesting little story with a clear storyline to it. We start off with a problem, with this patient had arrived and couldn't be seen, leading to a successful resolution, which came about thanks to the intervention of Sean herself. And we have four characters in this story. We have Sean, who's very much the protagonist. Then we have the antagonist, who was the doctor, who was kind of getting in the way. And then we have the two patients, who then provided their feedback on how happy they were at the end and how satisfied. And what we can get from this is that Sean was finding her work meaningful in the context of being able to come up with creative solutions to problems. She was able to use her knowledge and understanding of the patient to lead to a successful outcome that wouldn't have arisen otherwise. And this is an example of how she found her work meaningful. And this very much reflected the kind of themes we were getting in the stories that the nurses narrated to us. But often we found that there was a battle or a fight metaphor in the stories they told us. So they were battling with what they termed those upstairs, the hospital managers, or they were battling with doctors who had a different view on how to treat the patient. So it wasn't an easy thing for them to find this meaningfulness in their work. There was very much a sense that it was something they had to struggle for.
Very interesting. Let's move on to your second group then. Creative artists.
Here we were talking to actors, musicians, composers, writers and so on. What we found here was that they felt very conflicted about whether their work actually did make a meaningful contribution to society or not. Because it's quite an ephemeral thing if you think about it. If you're acting in a play, is that useful to society? Some of them talked about the kind of the kick they got from seeing their name up in lights. But when you talk to them in more depth, one of the things that they tended to say was that, well, we do feel our work is valuable because we feel we're enriching society. We're kind of feeding the soul. And some of them said, well, I think our work is as important as that of nurses and doctors, because without the arts, where would we be? And so they were very much casting around looking for ways to find this sense of meaning in their work. And where they were often challenged was through this fear of what they often called selling out. So doing maybe low-grade work, popular work, just simply in order to be able to put food on the table. Whereas, in fact, what they wanted to be doing was much more highbrow, intellectual, emotionally challenging work that they felt would be more meaningful.
So let's move on to your third group, the lawyers. I mean, how did they talk about the meaning of their work?
Well, the lawyers actually also felt fairly conflicted. So on the one hand, they said, well, we've got a great job. We're very lucky. We're very privileged to do this type of work. We're able to help people. These were claimant lawyers working on behalf of individuals who were perhaps making an employment tribunal claim. But on the other hand, they were very conscious of the negative perception of lawyers in wider society. So that one of them, so Carol, told us, you know, I'm not at all proud of being a lawyer and I never admit to being a lawyer. If I'm at a party and somebody says, what do you do for a living? I would never say I'm a lawyer. And she said, well, maybe what I should have done is done something else. Maybe I should have gone and been a carpenter, because I would have something tangible to show at the end of the day, something that I'd produced. It's very difficult to say, look at this amazing trust deed that I wrote today. Yes. And I think if you kind of stand back from the detail of the stories that we got, what we found was that there were three main characteristics that needed to be in place for people to feel, yes, I'm making a really good contribution here, and yes, my work is meaningful. And the first one was that they felt that they were making a contribution that they personally valued. So let's just take the example of the nurses. They were less interested in getting the patients through and out and emptying up the beds, or in necessarily coming up with the best medical solution for the patient. What they were interested in was the care and compassion that they were able to bring to the role, and looking at the patient in a very holistic way. Getting people out and through the hospital might be a good way of looking at a meaningful contribution if you're a hospital manager, but not so much if you're a nurse. And the second characteristic was feedback was very important. The kind of feedback we get from other people about how well we're doing our job and how much it matters to them. So in the case of nurses, here we have an occupation that's typically regarded by wider society as quite a meaningful job. And we saw that reflected in the recent pandemic, of course. If your job has a beneficiary, like a nurse has a patient or a creative artist has an audience, and you're getting good feedback, that will also bolster...
Someone who can say thanks.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Someone who can say thank you or explain how much you've improved their day or improved their life in some way. That really helps people to find their work meaningful.
But you don't actually consider other types of workers, for example, those in manual jobs. I mean, one would expect there'd be rather different findings here with different groups of workers or professionals, wouldn't you? I mean, these are three special cases, aren't they?
In wider research that I've done around meaningful work, I have spoken to people who are street sweepers, stonemasons, I've spoken to people who work in shops, many other different types of settings. And I think one of the things you can do is you can kind of stand back from the detail of what people are telling you. And if these three characteristics are in place, so feeling that you're able to contribute in a way that matters to you, getting the feedback that bolsters that sense that your view is the right one. And then thirdly, this sort of self-efficacy belief, feeling that you're able to do the work. So you've got the resources and the skills you need to be able to deliver on that work. And having those three in place at a pretty much a generic level seems to be what really matters.
You've been an academic most of your life, haven't you? Meaningful?
That's very interesting. It's something I think about a lot, obviously, because of my research. I do think about whether my work is meaningful or not. And I think probably pretty much in common with a lot of the people who take part in my research, I have days where I feel, yes, this is very meaningful. I had a great session teaching the students, or I got a paper published, or something really good happens. And other days where things are maybe a bit more routine or negative things happen. As academics, we get our papers rejected, we get negative feedback, and things like that can be quite demoralising. So it's one of these things that very much ebbs and flows as over your working day and indeed over your working life.
Thank you very much, Katie Bailey. Now, I had rather expected that last week's discussion on this programme, we remember we were talking about life at sea, were prompts and memories, and I wasn't mistaken. Joan Constance emailed with memories of her life at sea back in 1976. Laurie, I married my husband that year, and he worked as an engineer officer of a P&O General Cargo Division, and he was allowed to take his wife along with him on voyages. My life at sea was both interesting and educational. Are wives still allowed at sea? Probably not. And a very similar set of memories informed the email from Norma Tregoning, who travelled the world with her chief engineer husband. Laurie, I loved the life, but not the bad weather. These admirable correspondents wrote to me at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. Now, as I discovered during my job as an academic, lecturers and readers and professors are not typically early morning workers. Indeed, the prospect of having to give a lecture as early as 9 a.m. was regarded with the sort of dismay normally associated with a life sentence. And that is no doubt why no one ever thought to comment on the fact that their offices, their tutorial offices, routinely looked spick and span. No one knew very much about the army of early morning cleaners who had effected this transformation. But my next guest differed. These invisible workers became the principal subject of research detailed in a book entitled Dramas of Dignity, Cleaners in the Corporate Underworld of Berlin. And I'm now joined by its author, who is Jana Costa, who is Chair of People, Work and Management at the European University Viadrina in Frankfurt. Jana, your study was conducted in Berlin's Potsdamer Platz, which you describe as, I'm quoting from you, privately owned corporate designer micro-city right in the city centre. Fill out that picture for me. Tell me more about that location.
Potsdamer Platz, most people know because it's one of those iconic places you find in the background of tourist photos, advertisements, movie scenes like Babylon Berlin. It's a huge complex which is right in the center of town next to the Brandenburg Gate. And it really stands out in the cityscape because of its skyscrapers. It has glassy complexes and it's like a melange of colorful buildings that you wouldn't find anywhere else in Berlin. So it is a space which is owned by private companies. You usually don't have that in German cities. And everything there which would make up a micro city. So you find shopping malls, chain hotels, entertainment centers, cinemas, apartments, offices. And it's a space that caters to cosmopolitan residents, professionals, consumers, and tourists.
In an encounter more than 15 years ago, you're working then, I think, as a strategy consultant, helped spark your curiosity about cleaners and their work life. Tell me a little bit about that encounter all those years ago and the questions which it prompted for you.
So I worked as a consultant really late in the evening and the corridors started to empty, the lights started to turn off, and suddenly the door opens and there stands a young woman, almost the same age as me, in her cleaning uniform, and she seemed as startled as I was by this unforeseen encounter, and this was a cleaner. And I was interested in this sudden encounter, which I didn't expect, because it made me aware of the fact that quite different worlds of work we have. So on the one hand, you know, the well-paid office worker, the consultant, and on the other hand, this rather low-paid service worker. Why is this cleaner there so late? It's because of the hours of the office workers. So they start working so late or so early in the morning because of the rhythms and the work life of those service recipients. And that's what I wanted to look at. So what does it mean for a cleaner to take on this role? How do they perceive themselves? And how do they perceive those for whom they provide their services? These worlds of work are interlinked.
Now, you use the word underworld to denote the setting for your study of this, in a way, the largely invisible working life of cleaners employed by a company I think you call Cleanup. Tell me a little bit more about that underworld.
The underworld is this huge invisible area, 4-level deep, below Potsdamer Platz. And compared to the, what I therefore in my book call the upper world, it's stuffy, it's dark, sometimes it stinks because there's the garbage collection point, it has low ceilings, often you don't have any cell phone reception. So it's really a very different world than the world most of us know when they visit Potsdamer Platz. So I talk about this as the underworld from a spatial perspective, but also, and I think this is equally important, I use this notion in a figurative sense because this very spatial allocation says something, I believe, about the status of the cleaners. And in fact, one cleaner spoke about himself as a minus man, as a person of the underworld. So this says a lot about this corporate microcity where there is, on the one hand, these, you know, shiny offices, these glass complexes and the skyscrapers on top that we can see. And underneath it, you have this kind of backstage service area where you find the cleaners, but also all sorts of other service workers.
Now, after you've got through some initial introduction, you did find that people opened up to you, talked to you more than you expected. How did people react to your presence?
I actually thought that they would react rather negatively. But on the very first day, the first morning break at 9 a.m., so we started working at 5, and I said, my name is Jana, I'm a researcher from the university, and I'm going to work alongside you because I'm interested in finding out what it means to do this kind of work. And to my surprise, the cleaners reacted quite positively. So one cleaner, she was called Mommy, said, well, at last, somebody is looking at what we do here instead of taking it for granted. And I think this reaction to me was very interesting because from the start, it showed how important a sense of recognition, of appreciation is for the cleaners. I was working alongside the cleaners for about 6 months. I spent all sorts of shifts with them. So we cleaned, for example, the spaces outside at Potsdamer Platz. So you would pick up cigarette butts around the squares and the streets. Or I did a lot of interior cleaning alongside the cleaners, you know, from cleaning the shopping center, offices, reception rooms, public toilets, apartments. So I really tried to share as much as I could their work life.
And interestingly, their shifts are organised in such a way that they don't really meet the office workers, or they don't generally encounter the public.
There's a rule at Potsdamer Platz that after 9 a.m, the cleaners, especially with their trolleys, are not supposed to be visible above ground. So they use the tunnels, the corridors, you know, from one building to get to another. So therefore, one doesn't see them. Plus, as I already said, they are temporarily also invisibilized to the extent that they'll start working already at 5. It's not just a temporal and spatial question of invisibilization. It's also a social one. So even when office workers can see them, they still don't greet them. They ignore them. They interact with them as if they're not there. In fact, this happened to me as well. So I was wearing the cleaning uniform. I was picking up cigarette butts and doing other things outside. And a colleague from university passed by and he wouldn't greet me. He didn't recognize me. He didn't see me.
As you point out, in service work like cleaning, educational work experience barriers to entry are pretty low. So workforce diversity seem to be correspondingly high. Give me a little sense of the variety of cleaners you met. What did they have in common, if anything?
So they were young and old, male and female, German and foreign cleaners. And I kind of discovered maybe four groups. So you would have skilled workers who have taken what used to be a traditional route to cleaning. They are taking vocational training. So they're about to become what's called also glass cleaners. And they very much see cleaning still as a craft. Then you have also skilled workers. For example, I met a cleaner called Ali, who is of Turkish origin. And they would have a training in another profession. So he used to be, let's say, a machine operator. But you also could find people who used to be hairdressers. And they entered this occupation because they were facing unemployment in the work they were trained in. And there are two more groups. Both of them are more the unskilled workers. So I encountered, for example, Luisa from Mozambique. She just arrived in Berlin. She barely spoke any German, and she was placed there through the German Job Center. So this is the institution responsible for the unemployed. And the last group I interacted with, these were people like Marcel, who talks about himself as a failed existence, so a dropout who has a history of drug addiction. So you can really see various paths, you can say, into this occupation. But at the same time, what they all share, none of them, you know, have an academic background. All of them, you can say, are part of the working, the lower class. And for them, work is their main, if not only, way to gain status in society. So what they have in common is that they actually display a very high work ethic and they turn to their work to develop a sense of self-worth.
Scholars who are looking at the sort of work you're describing often refer to it as dirty work. I mean, these people are dealing with matter that people prefer not to see, smell or touch. All that makes cleaning a rather stigmatised occupation. Little status, little respect, little pay, really. But nevertheless, your book, it's entitled Dramas of Dignity.
And I speak about dramas of dignity because dignity has two sides. Dignity is about a sense of self-worth, but also the way in which I'm recognized and appreciated by others. And what I discovered that amongst the cleaners, these two sides are in conflict. So while the cleaners seek to derive self-worth from their work, outsiders often show them little recognition and respect precisely because of their work. It's not everyone who I encountered there feels that they need to cope with a sense of shame. So given their social backgrounds and where they come from, they were from the start, some of them very proud to have work in the first place. So how do the cleaners try to derive or do actually derive some dignity from their work? For example, first of all, they gain some kind of status through working in the first place. Some of them are also extremely proud when they manage to clean up, you know, nasty messes. They are proud when they can work independently and are not constantly controlled. On the one hand, therefore, they do search for and sometimes even find a sense of dignity in their work. However, and now comes the drama, often this kind of dignity is denied in the everyday encounter. And these can be encounters with customers or people who are in the complex above ground. When a cleaner tries to mop the floor in the shopping mall and somebody wouldn't move just an inch so she could mop. Or when tourists throw some kind of garbage in front of your foot instead of putting it into the bin, which is 1 meter away from them. Or when their good morning is not responded. It's these kind of interactions on an everyday basis that send to cleaners the message and give them a sense that they are not really worthy members of society. Dignity is denied to the cleaners also when the supervisors survey them a lot, and which gives them a sense of, okay, that they're not really trusted, that they don't really want to do their work.
These cleaners showed little interest in, if you like, defining themselves as a group or expressing any sort of solidarity with each other. They were almost preoccupied with their own individuality. Expand on that for me.
So I made the mistake sometimes to talk about the room in the basement as a team room. And then the cleaner said to me, "What are you talking about? We are not a team. We don't want to be a team." So they actually actively worked against the idea of forming a community. And what I discovered over time, that they were constantly creating this differentiation. So the man versus the woman, the young versus the old, the Germans versus the non-Germans. There was a lot of racism there as well. And my explanation for that is that the sense of a lack of barrier into this occupation makes cleaners feel inferior and easily replaceable. They have a sense that they're this kind of uneducated, unskilled worker that is exactly the kind of stigma that surrounds this occupation. So they become a nobody. And it's against this sense that they develop all kinds of replacement hierarchies through internal differentiation. But of course, these internal hierarchies they try to set, the kind of status hierarchy, they often collapse as soon as they come in contact with the outside world, for whom they are just one group.
Now, towards the end of your book, you speculate about whether the presence of invisible service workers in corporate underworlds, the ones you've been describing, marks a return of the servant society, you know, one pretty familiar to us from British TV series like Upstairs, Downstairs, Downton Abbey, as well, of course, from George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London. What did you conclude?
What's important to understand inequality is not just to look at it from an economic point of view, but also to look at the way in which it's produced, reproduced, and experienced in everyday interactions. And so for all the talk you could say about the newness and the city for the 21st century around Potsdamer Platz, it is actually reminiscent of former forms of invisible service work. There's, of course, a difference to the kind of service workers you would find, you know, in Downton Abbey, because here we talk about service work that's outsourced, and therefore the service workers find themselves in this triangle between the company on the one hand and the service recipients on the other hand. What is interesting about my study, that there's this inequality in the midst of our city, of my city, which at the same time becomes invisibilized. And also today's middle classes increasingly depend on very different kinds of servants to manage their social and working lives. So you can think about a couple with children and how they outsource cleaning, housework, even food shopping in order to keep up their lives. So in that sense, I believe my study is significant in showing the kind of invisible inequality, especially around service work, that we find in the midst of us.
Thank you, Jana Costa. Thank you so much. Let me come back to you very briefly, Katie. Listening to that, how does that, if you like, relate to your own work?
I was very struck by what Jana said about the amount of pride that the cleaners felt in the work that they were doing. And I think perhaps it's easy to assume that meaningful work is just something for elite occupations. I've done research with street sweepers in the past, and in the same way as Jana has found with the cleaners that she was researching, there was a huge amount of pride in the work that was being done, a sense of achievement at the end of the day when they'd managed to clean the street and it looked so much better than it did before. But again, what undermined their sense of meaningful work was lack of recognition, as Jan has put it, or poor negative feedback from people, and also the way that perhaps they were being treated by their company, by their employer as well, which didn't help them to find that sense of meaningfulness.
Thank you so much, Katie. Well, that's all for this week. Next week I'll be making friends with Birdseye and with Cowan Gate and Draft Guinness and Huntley and Palmer as I discuss the secret lives of food packaging.
Thinking Aloud is presented by Laurie Taylor and produced by Jane Edgerton. This week we'll take a fresh look at a famous mystery.
One winter's night in 1974, a crime took place that would obsess the nation.
We're still looking for Lucan, all over the world.
Lord Lucan is said to have killed the family nanny and to have attacked his wife before disappearing. Why has this, of all crimes, captured our imagination?
It's partly that the evidence is so murky.
As I try to get to the bottom of the case, my preconceptions are blown apart.
I mean, this is a pretty weird stuff to have in a box, isn't it? What on earth is this for?
The Lucan Obsession with me, Alex von Tunzelman, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45.
Now on Radio 4, on your farm, and today Cass Graham is in Staffordshire with her wellies on.
It is muddy, isn't it?
Well, here it is.
Let me just grab you, because I'm falling over here.
Our latest project.
Oh, my goodness. Right, just tell me what we're looking at.
So here we're actually building a reservoir where we want to store more water on farm so we can use it to grow our crops.
Right, and what we've got in front of us is basically a massive hole, isn't it?
It is. It's going to hold about 25,000 cube of water, 25,000 tonne of water. Towards 2 acres in size, I'd say, really.
Yeah. And what used to be here?
It was an old marl pit historically. So in the old days, they'd have used marl on the land as like a fertiliser. There was a bit of water in the bottom, but basically we've just made it much bigger to utilise the space, really.
Yeah, and we can see the bare soil, and it is one massive hole. How long have you been excavating here?
Well, this is the challenge. I thought it might be finished by now, but obviously with the weather and the current wet weather we're having at the moment, we think things are delayed. We had the grant agreed in January. We started digging in the spring. Hopefully we're going to get it finished before winter kicks in, but I'm a bit nervous at the moment with the way things are looking. Yeah.
I'm with Richard Bower at Lower Drayton Farm, which lies somewhere between Stafford and Wolverhampton in the West Midlands. And this is a truly mixed farm, Richard. 750 acres in total, with so many different things going on this farm. Now, you farm here alongside your dad, Ray, who we're going to catch up with in a little bit. And we'll talk more about this big hole in a moment. Before we do, though, just tell us a little about the farm. What do you do here when you're not digging out enormous reservoirs?
Yeah, no, welcome to the farm. We are a family farm, essentially. We're the third generation to be farming here now. I've got children as well, so hopefully they'll have the opportunity to farm in the future. Historically, beef and cereals was the main part of the business, with a few potatoes. But really, we've had to diversify just because of make ourselves more resilient, really, and the uncertainty within the industry. The weather affects us, global markets affect us. So we're in a very good location here, and we've basically diversified into opening up to the public.
Yeah, you said that traditionally you grow cereals, but you grow pumpkins, you grow sunflowers, you grow all kinds of different things now, all as an effort to get the public onto this farm. Tell me about how you've kind of changed this farm into... It's almost like a public attraction now, isn't it?
It is. And I realise more and more every day that we're an events business at the end of the day for young families coming out to enjoy the countryside, but just to have a bit of fun on the farm as well. We've built a big children's play barn on the farm, which is part of a farm park. And then basically our events are all about the school holidays through the calendar year. So lambing in the spring, maize in the summer, pumpkins in the autumn, and then we do Christmas events at Christmas as well.
And you had 125,000 visitors on the farm last year.
We did, and we want more, basically. So very ambitious, and we just want to keep growing and keep pushing. And yeah, we really, really appreciate everyone coming to visit us.
Yeah, and everything that you do here seems to be about forward thinking. You built an anaerobic digester as well, so you can produce renewable energy to keep this farm viable for the future as well.
Again, can't take all the credit for this, but always try and look forward. The main reason is my grandparents who went before us, they were forward-thinking for their time as well, to be honest, that they bought these farms in the first place and gave us these opportunities, and they're always looking outside the box and looking for new ideas. Needs must as well, to be honest. If you don't innovate, you evaporate.
So we've just come down a really steep, muddy bank, and we are now on, I suppose, what will be the bottom of the reservoir. Is that right?
We are. We've come down 6 metres. I'll be honest, we actually want to go a little bit deeper if the weather allows as well, and we've come into the reservoir here. This project really is working with the natural landscape. So where we are was almost an existing hollow, and we've just continued it around the corner just to increase the capacity of the reservoir.
Why are you building this? How big a problem is water for you?
It's funny, the last two summers water hasn't been an issue, but the climate is changing and we need it as an insurance policy. The pumpkins are one of our most important crops and they need water over the summer, ready for Halloween. We grow potatoes on the farm, carrots on the farm, parsnips on the farm. Very proud to grow fresh produce on our farm.
And with this reservoir, when it is finally built, I mean, will it just fill naturally or will you need to... fill it from the river
exactly.
with abstraction?
Exactly. Well, you
water.
See, there's water in here already because yeah. we had a month's worth of rain at the end of September just in one weekend, and we can't believe how much it's caught already. So, yeah, it'll be more 80-20, to be honest. 80% of it will be abstraction, and 20% will be from land drains and the natural environment. But Dad Liam's say he thinks it's going to attract a lot of wildlife on the farm as well, to be honest. It's going to be a bit of a nature haven as well. So, yeah, we're really proud of it and can't wait to get it finished.
You mentioned the pumpkins and how they are water hungry. That is one of the crops that you have brought onto this farm in order to attract the public. You don't even pick them yourselves because obviously they are pick your own pumpkins. Can we go and take a look at that aspect of the farm?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go.
Well, we just jumped out of the car because we spotted your dad, Ray, in a field full of sheep. Tell me why you have these sheep.
There's 100 ewes down here, and they're down here with three tups. The tups went in September, and we're hoping to have new lambs around Valentine's Day, and that really coincides with Fabio half term on the farm, when we hope to try and welcome about 6,000 visitors to see lambing live on the farm.
So the sheep really are to produce lambs for an event?
100%, yes.
I mean, your dad's been a livestock man through and through, mainly beef, to be honest, all his life, hasn't he?
Yes, yeah, he has. I mean, he'll tell you how many markets he used to go to every week and how many cattle he used to deal with. So, and my granddad was a big cattle man as well, to be honest.
Right, Ray, good morning.
Good morning.
Hello. Very nice to meet you.
And you, yep.
We've got a couple of young people who I believe are students on the farm as well.
Yeah.
What have you lot been doing?
Doing the sheep's feed, checking. Cluen, I don't know how to spell it, pronounce the name right, is doing a management training. Can you tell them what you do, your course?
Yeah, so I'm in Harper Adams, a university, doing agricultural business. And then as part of my third year, we have to go out on placement. And then I chose to come to Lower Drayton Farm just because they could give me that experience with like managing the team and to see how the farm's like diverse. And that's something I'm quite interested in.
Oh, interesting.
So she doesn't just manage, she does get her hands dirty,
yeah.
Look. but coming from Wales, her family... know more about sheep than perhaps we do ourselves.
Well, will you need her? Hearing from Richard that you've just got the sheep in for the
lambing. This is Delta, who's been with us.
Started
how long ago?
A year ago. I'm at Rod Baston College doing agriculture level 3.
Yeah.
So my hope is, after my course, to go to Harper Adams and hopefully start up my own farm with myself.
Great stuff. Ray, tell me about these sheep we've got. What different varieties do we have? Because they look like a real mix-match of sheep.
Licorice all sorts, different breeds. These are farmed commercially, but also their attraction to our customers. February half term, we lamb quite early. So we get 6,000-8,000 people half term February. People like to see it and fresh-born lambs.
And it's a beautiful farm. We're here, surrounded by this lovely, lush, green countryside. We've got lots of woodland over there. There's a river just sort of snaking its way in the bottom. We have to say, we can hear the M6 as well, because you are really close to the M6.
I'm afraid so.
Tell us a bit about how the farm came to be in your family.
My granddad came from Cheshire in the 40s. My dad started renting the next door farm. He bought that in 63. He then bought another block of ground in 72, And then in 82, we bought Lower Drayton.
Is it true that you told Richard there was no money in farming? And that he should probably have just, you know, head off and go and do something else when he was there?
I mean, it's a way of life. We live off the farm. If we have a good time, a bad time, we tighten our belts, as you might say. And if we earn any money, we're going to spend it to extend the farm. So, that's how it is, but we're still here. And
yeah. No, I can remember about the time I did my GCSEs in the early thousands, wheat was £60 a tonne, and there was no money in growing wheat at £60 a tonne. And I remember I said to Dad once, well, why are you doing it? And he says, because that's what we do, basically. You have to just keep grinding through some years.
But you didn't come straight into the farm, did you?
No, I went to Harper Adams, but I did a degree in food marketing and business studies rather than straight agriculture, and that broadened my horizons and opened my eyes up. I've been very, very lucky to grow up on a family farm, but sometimes you grow up on a family farm and think you know everything. It's not until you go and see other people that you realise that you know absolutely nothing. And I think as you get older, you realise that as well. Yeah. You're quite sure of yourself when you're in your early 20s, and you get a bit older and you realise, actually, yeah, there's still lots to learn. And Dad will say that at 72 as well, really. But the one thing we do, we complement each other quite well as well. So we focus on different areas and, yeah, we try and work together, but, sometimes, like most families, but we have our moments as well. When we built the play barn, we had to make a decision how we were going to build it. It was one Sunday afternoon, and Dad wanted to build it one way in the farmyard. I wanted to build it another way in the farmyard. We were shouting across the farmyard at each other, bickering, and then actually we came up with a hybrid idea of the two, basically. Part my idea and part of his idea, and it's worked.
Seems to have worked anyway.
Yeah, so sometimes the conflict is actually a positive thing, I'd say, really. Or fighting your corner is a positive thing.
Well, one of the first things that you did on this farm to invite the public in was to grow these pumpkins. We were on our way when we spotted you, Ray.
So yeah, yeah.
We should maybe go and have a look at them.
Yeah.
We've come to see the pumpkins, and I can see pumpkins in front of me. However, to my right-hand side, I was not expecting to see what we have here. We have a T-Rex that must be about 4 metres
high. Yeah, that our customers have named Tiny the T-Rex.
They definitely
get our sense of humour as well. He's a life-size T-Rex. He's 15 metres long.
Is he?
Dippy the Diplodocus as well.
Right. So,
but what we've seen really with opening this business and the events business, lots of people in the local area now are up in the game as well. And it's quite a competitive market, and it's a growing market. So again, how can we be different? How can we differentiate ourselves? How can we be unique? So yeah, quirky, but it works really.
Right, okay.
And kids love dinosaurs at the end of the day, so
well,
it works
of course
really, really
they do.
Well.
So yeah. Look, we're walking to a pumpkin grotto now, I think. Could we describe it as?
Yeah.
They're massive, some of these pumpkins, aren't they?
Yeah, so this is brand new for this year. And okay. It's our entrance into the pumpkin field. It's called a pumpkin house. Basically, right. Decorated with all the pumpkins that are grown on the farm. There's 20 different varieties of pumpkins, and you're right, some of them are actually gigantic.
Yeah.
But also, we tell our customers the secret ingredient to growing our pumpkins is using dinosaur poo as fertiliser, you see. So,
and how much do you charge people to come and get their pumpkins?
£13 a person. We're different to other farms, so we sell it as a ticket price, basically. The great thing with the ticket price is we start selling tickets in March for this event. We've almost covered the price of the seeds by the time we get to the end of summer, and we also know how many people are coming as well. We think if you were free and then you just charge for the pumpkins on the day, you're more like a shop, like a retailer, and then you're competing with the supermarkets. We don't want to compete with the supermarkets. We want to sell an experience, and then they get to carve it here as well.
Let's keep going to
exactly.
Find some pumpkins.
Exactly.
One of the other things that you've done this year is you've had another event. You've become a real event inventor, haven't you? You've had a kind of what they call a harvest hoedown. And that again has involved people coming in and picking their own veg.
Exactly.
I guess some of the kids who come here, they won't have picked veg before.
But they haven't, and it's fantastic. So September's usually a very quiet month for us. It's because after the summer holidays, kids back to school, people are saving up for Christmas. Last year, for example, we had 2,500 visitors in September. This year with the Harvest Hoedown, we've had 6,000 visitors, and they've been able to harvest potatoes, carrots, leeks, red onions, and beetroot as well. Like sometimes with the potatoes, we say, have as many as you want, because there's 60 tonne of potatoes here. There's a 3-acre patch, there could be 60 tonne of potatoes. Fill your boots, and they are. They're filling their pockets full of potatoes.
We've got a whole field of pumpkins in front of us here, and really interestingly, they're all different shapes, sizes, colours, all in the same field. Let's go and
so we planted
take a bit of a look, shall
we? This is a 20-acre patch, and I would say to the customers about the size of 20 football pitches, and we've planted 100,000 seeds and about 20 different varieties. But what we do, we mix all the seeds up, because rather than have all the white ones in one corner and the big ones in another, we want the customers to be able to just walk through and find whatever pumpkin. I mean, look, there's blue ones, there's pink ones, there's all different shapes, and they're all together.
Are there favourites? What do people most like? I mean, we've got one that is like your traditional sort of basketball almost in front of us, haven't we?
Exactly.
Huge one. And then these ones look almost like Gaia melons, don't they?
Yeah, they are. And they've got the goosebump on them. What we find is, so we open up...
Just tell me, what do you mean they've got the goosebump on them? What do you mean?
See, it's almost like acne almost, you see, and they're bred to grow like that. I mean,
right.
You see there's another one over there, a tiny one that's really bumpy. So, again, that's the spooky feel of it.
Yeah. What do you do with the ones that aren't bought up for carving?
The crazy thing is, after Halloween, nobody wants a pumpkin, unfortunately. And also, it's quite interesting how half-term lands as well. Sometimes Halloween's right in the middle of half-term. Well, really, we want Halloween at the end of half-term, so we get as many visitors on farm as possible. But for the last 4 years, we work with the Lions Club, which is a national charity. They come and harvest them, and then work with another company called Fair Share, and they go to food banks all around the UK, actually. We don't charge them anything for that. So they'll harvest as many as they can. The rest of them we'll actually just leave for nature as well, to be honest. We actually think we've seen English partridge numbers go up as well, because there's more feed for them.
Ray, I wonder what your dad would have thought about growing this crop, which is almost all for playing with, not eating.
Yeah,
it's not a crop.
You say that, it's surprising how many people do take them home, because we do the carving. People say, you're not going to carve. And they say, oh, no, we're going to make soup out of them, or different things.
Yeah. And huge signposts in this field, like letters that are about, I don't know, 8 foot, 9 foot tall, saying pumpkins. So there's absolutely no mistaking what is going on this farm here.
That's for the photo opportunity.
It's inviting the public in all the time. And that is, presumably, that is how this farm makes most of its money.
It is, to be honest. We're still farming and we're still proud to farm. When we first started doing the budgets, it did look as if we were going to reduce our farming activities a bit. But then when COVID hit and lockdown hit and we couldn't open this side of the business, we were glad to still be farming and still sell produce as well, really. So we are going to keep farming, but the diversified business is now four times bigger than the farm, to be honest, from an income point of view.
Now, the play barn is, I think, the biggest development in terms of bringing the public onto this farm. We can see it just from where we're standing here. It is massive. You've developed it as a really quite big visitor attraction, and it is still growing. Can we go and take a look?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We've come to the main farm, and this is where you invite people in. We've got a load of really lovely, contented-looking... What are they? Are they Herefords?
There's some Herefords, yeah. The red ones are the white face of Herefords.
We've
got a total mixed breed of cattle, the same as the sheep, because our customers like all different characteristics of the animals.
And you've got your donkey, you've got your llama. Your dad was telling me that you've got names for all the cows.
Our customers name the cows usually when the calf's been born. Jim is the big Aberdeen Angus bull. He's named after my granddad, so that's quite a nice sentiment. Mental things, really.
But what a lot of people come here for is you've got a massive soft play area, haven't you? And we are walking into that area now. It's called the play barn because it is like a massive barn, but it's got everything that kids need to play on. Here we go.
Exactly. And to give you some context, where the large play frame is, that used to be the grain shed that Dad and Grandad used to be. Where the smaller baby area is, that used to be the potato shed. And this used to be the farmyard in front of us, which is now the cafe.
Now, not everybody is familiar with soft play areas if they haven't got kids or grandkids and don't have to go to them. But this is enormous as they go. So you've got all these climbing frames, you've got all of this... well, foam stuff so that kids can climb about, fall on it, not hurt themselves.
And the slides, the big purple slide as well is what everybody loves, and that's what everyone comes for. It's a big 6 metre slide, Astro slide. The whole family go down it. This has been built for adults as well, so it's fun for everybody. The great thing about it, it's a massive investment, probably costs the same as a combine harvester, but you only need one or two people to man it as well. So you can have 300 kids on there and only one or two staff on there, so it's a brilliant, brilliant investment.
Well, we've also been joined by Hannah. Hannah, what's your role on this farm?
So I am the office manager. I support with some of the shift management, help with planning events, so a real variety.
How many staff now work here?
There are a lot, somewhere in the region of about 70. So yeah, lots and lots of people doing lots of different jobs,
And the things that you have to think about now, Richard, they are so different. Health and safety, insurance, goodness knows, so many things. It's a completely different business to running a farm.
Exactly, and that's why we've got great people like Hannah as well. And Hannah does a lot to do with customer service as well, replying to emails as well. We get so many different questions from different people, and it's so important that we listen to those. But yeah, one thing, I'm really proud. We employ 70 people. It makes us sweat, it makes us pay a lot of wages every month, but I'm proud to be able to do that, support the local community as well, and support the local economy as well. So yeah, I think it's great.
Well, the reason it's so quiet in here today is because you're closed. It's probably just as well, because you wouldn't have been able to show us around otherwise. How hands-on are you and your dad?
Yeah, we're here most days. When we built this place, I thought we were going to be open every day of the week. I thought, gosh, we've spent massive investment, we need to get the money back. We've realised when children are at school, there's no point us being open so much. So we close Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays. So on those days, we do school visits on the farm as well. So it helps us to keep people coming to the farm and keep a regular workforce as well, really.
About 150 schools a year, like what I did last year.
This farm has changed so much, Ray, since when you started farming
here. Yeah.
What is it like for you, welcoming all of these people on the farm?
I like people. Richard helps.
Just as well.
It helps. Yeah, my brother, he said he'd never do it. He says he's not a people person. We started, I suppose, originally when the government in 96, was it, started to encourage school visits. So we started then, so we've been going quite a few years doing those type of things, and it's just built over the last 10 or 12 years.
Most farmers say, get off my land, whereas we're saying, come on, get on our farm, and yeah, as many as possible.
Yeah. Some people would say, well, why do you carry on farming at all? Because you're making all your money here. What's the point of carrying on farming?
It's our show. The farm is our show as well. As seasonal things, we couldn't do it without the farm, and people do come because we're on the farm, you know. I meet people on the door and you say to the children, what have you come to see? I've come to see the animals.
I think the other thing, you've got to do what you enjoy as well, really, and trust me, we probably spend too much time farming, really, but it's what we enjoy, and we're proud to produce British food as well, so we're proud of what we do. The team probably think, oh, what crazy idea Richard and Ray going to come up with next, isn't it, really?
Definitely, yeah.
We keep everyone on the toes.
We have a little bit of a management meeting. It's definitely, oh, what's going to get thrown at us today? What are we going to have to deliver over the next few months? But, yeah, a great environment to work in.
Well, Ray, never the same, is it?
No.
Never the same.
Ray, I know that you possibly get your inspiration from the way you start the day every day. You come out and you do something every morning that you couldn't have done before this play barn was built here. And we're just going to walk from the main play barn into, well, what do you call this bit here?
Adventure barn.
Oh, I can see why you call it the adventure barn, because there's a practically vertical slide in front of us.
Yeah, so I have to test it every morning. And then I always challenge the dads. Compulsory they go down this red slide.
Right, well, look, it's got two halves to it. Shall you go down one side and I'll go down the other side?
Oh, well, that's a good sounds plan.
Excellent. Let's do it. Oh, my goodness me. We have come up to the top of this slide, and it is vertical. I'm feeling slightly nervous about it now, but off we go. One, two, three, go! Woo! Ray, that's brilliant.
Well,
if I had one of those, I'd be doing it every morning.
Well, that's right. It just has to be tested, you know what I mean?
Well, we've had a brilliant day here today. Thank you so much to Ray and Richard Bauer for inviting us to look around Lower Drayton Farm.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Pleasure for you to come. Thank you very much.
On Your Farm was presented by Kaz Graham. The producer was Emma Campbell. The clocks have gone back, but as far as we know, that hasn't affected the weather. To tell us, with the forecast, here's Matt Taylor.
Not quite yet, anyway, John, but we are sliding towards winter now following the clock change. Very good morning to you, and quite a chilly morning out there with some clear skies to get the day underway. Temperatures in some rural parts of each of the four nations close to freezing in a few areas. But it's a lovely start to Sunday. There will be some changes, though, to the north and west, much like we saw through yesterday. So let's start the details in Western Scotland and Northern Ireland. Western Scotland in particular already have one or two showers around, but a fine start for many. Good deal of sunshine. Northern Ireland, sunny spells, but already cloud creeping in from the west. We'll turn cloudy here through the morning. Outbreaks of rain or drizzle starting to develop, turning heavier into the afternoon and spreading into Western Scotland through the afternoon as well, with a strengthening breeze. For eastern Scotland and northern England, north and west Wales and the Isle of Man, sunny morning to come, a few isolated fog patches, they should clear fairly readily. Best of the sunshine though will be this morning. Through the afternoon, cloud gradually increases, and by the end of the afternoon into the evening, we'll start to see outbreaks of rain, a drizzle develop quite extensively. And again, the breeze will be picking up. To the south and east of Wales, for the Midlands, East Anglia, all of southern England and the Channel Islands, there's just one or two areas of cloud around, but for the vast majority, a sunny start, any mist and fog again, quickly clearing, and a fine day ahead, light winds, lots of sunshine around as well, and even though temperatures down on yesterday, it should feel pleasant with a bit more sunshine to the south and east. So temperatures today, southern England, 14 to 16, most of us though, around 10 to 13 Celsius, so close to where we should be for this stage in late October. Through tonight, after initial dip in temperature into single figures, they will lift through the night as we see mild and breezy as well as cloudy and also wet conditions spread across many areas, outbreaks of rain or drizzle. So it does mean for the start of the working week, Monday will be a fairly cloudy day, rain or drizzle possible just about anywhere. Some of the dampest conditions will be on the hills and coasts. In the west will be quite misty, a few brighter breaks to the east of high ground. And that is how your weather's looking. John, back to you.
Thank you, Matt. And of course, you can find a detailed forecast for wherever you're spending your Sunday via the BBC Weather website or the BBC Weather app. After the news and a look at the morning papers, Julie Etchingham will explore the ethical and religious issues of the week in Sunday. And this week, in the second tranche of prison releases in England and Wales, 1,100 criminals serving sentences of 5 years or more were released from prison early to ease the overcrowding crisis. So how can faith groups support ex-prisoners trying to move on with their lives? We'll hear how people of faith are approaching the subject of assisted dying, and Nuns on the Bus, a group of Catholic sisters and interfaith partners in the US, encouraging people to be multi-issue voters. We'll get aboard in Pennsylvania. Julie will be here with Sunday at 10 past seven. And with the US election fast approaching, a little later this morning, James Naughtie continues his series exploring America's restless search for meaning, today reflecting on the conundrum of immigration in the US. Naughtie on America is at 10 to 9 this morning. And the eyes of the world will soon be on the United States of America.
Join Americast on the road to the US election.
It's the BBC podcast full of lively chats about politics,
with social media investigations
and experts on the ground.
We'll guide you through all the key moments as the United States chooses which direction to go in next.
Navigate your way to Election Day and beyond.
Americast.
Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 27th of October. Good morning. This is Alan Smith. The Chancellor says her budget on Wednesday will be for the strivers. Israel has denied that its airstrikes on Iran avoided oil facilities because of American pressure. The King is to resume a full schedule of overseas trips as he continues his cancer treatment. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says she will deliver a budget for the strivers this week. Writing in The Sun on Sunday, Ms. Reeves says she will take an iron grip on the country's finances, but ensure Britain's working people are better off. The Conservatives say the budget is shaping up to be a nightmare for the British public. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Rachel Reeves is blunt. Not everything is going to be easy, she writes. The Chancellor is preparing to raise the amount businesses pay in employer national insurance contributions. That's despite allegations from Conservatives it breaks Labour's manifesto promise not to increase taxes on working people. Ms Reeves denies that, saying it will be a budget for the strivers, and insists her decisions on tax will be tough but fair. Ms Reeves is also to change how debt is measured to allow more borrowing for infrastructure projects. There are warnings that could keep interest rates higher and mortgages more expensive. But as well as releasing more money for housing, schools and energy projects, the government is expected to announce in the coming days some of that extra spending will be used for a programme to rebuild hospitals. Addressing those on NHS waiting lists or being taught in crumbling classrooms or who can't afford a home, the Chancellor writes, "I've got your back."
The Chancellor's spending commitments will include a pledge to rebuild or refurbish 50 schools in England every year. More details from our education correspondent Hazel Shearing.
Rachel Reeves has promised £1.4 billion for the school rebuilding programme. The scheme, announced 4 years ago, aims to rebuild or refurbish about 500 schools in a decade. The BBC recently revealed that 23 schools have been completed and targets for hiring builders have been missed. The Treasury said the money represented a £550 million increase that would ramp up progress. But a teaching union said there was still a shortfall in funding for school buildings. The Chancellor also said she would triple spending on free breakfast clubs for primary school pupils and has committed to spending £1.8 billion on the expansion of free childcare hours.
The government is to provide extra support to military families so they're not affected when VAT is added to private school fees from January. The money will be provided through an existing allowance for armed forces families who send their children to boarding school because they move home so often. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the targets of Israeli airstrikes on Iran on Friday night were not dictated by the United States. He was responding to suggestions that Israel had avoided attacking Iranian gas and oil facilities because of American pressure. Mr. Netanyahu said the targets were chosen in line with Israel's national interests. Sebastian Osher sent this report from Jerusalem.
The consequences of Israel's retaliatory attack on Iran are likely to depend on how much damage the airstrikes did to vital elements of Iran's military capability. But the fact that they don't appear to have been aimed at Iran's economic infrastructure or its nuclear facilities has potentially lessened the imperative Tehran may feel to further raise the stakes in the showdown with Israel. President Biden has said he hopes the cycle of escalation between the two countries may now end, but the implication that Israel yielded to American pressure on the choice of its target seems to have rankled the Israeli Prime Minister. Mr. Netanyahu has not yet given a public address since the attack on Iran, but his office moved quickly, not only to insist that Israel's choice of targets was entirely its own decision, but also to dismiss a media report that it had given Iran advance notice of the attack.
The King is to return to a normal schedule of engagements next year after coping well with his tour of Australia and Samoa. A royal aide said the trip had been the perfect tonic for the King as he continued his cancer treatment. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
The tour of Australia and Samoa was the King's biggest test since his cancer diagnosis. Those working closely with him said the visit had lifted his spirits, mood and recovery. Although the King's cancer treatment is ongoing, a senior royal official said a full overseas tour programme was being planned for next year, as well as public engagements in the UK. The royal aide said the King was a great believer in mind, body and soul, that his sense of duty kept his mind and soul engaged, while doctors made sure his body was properly looked after. The King was said to have been completely unruffled by the protests in Canberra, believing free speech to be the cornerstone of democracy.
In the last few moments, the Electoral Commission in Georgia has said the ruling party won the parliamentary election. Georgian Dream is said to have polled 54% of the vote. Pro-Western opposition parties say there have been numerous reports of voting violations. The election is seen as pivotal in determining whether Georgia aligns itself more closely with Europe and the West or with Russia. Voting is underway in Japan's snap general election. It was called by the new Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba within days of taking office earlier this month. The ruling Liberal Democratic Party has been in power almost continuously since 1955, but has seen its approval ratings plummet this year in the wake of a scandal over political donations. A month-long Vatican summit has ended with a call for women to be given more leadership roles in the Catholic Church, but it stops short of saying that women should be allowed to become priests. Our religion editor Ali McBool reports from the Vatican.
In a summit meant to discuss all the issues rank-and-file Catholics around the world care about, the role of women in the Church was high on the agenda. After years of consultation and a month of discussions, the final summit document said women formed the majority of churchgoers, but acknowledged they continue to encounter obstacles in getting more recognition. It called for more women to be given the types of leadership roles which are already open to them, but it did not recommend allowing women to become members of the clergy. That's something a leading Catholic women's rights group described as an insufficient and disappointing response. On another issue raised by Catholics in tens of thousands of listening sessions around the world, reform groups had also hoped for concrete ways to better welcome LGBT plus people in the church. But no such proposals were made, and gay Catholics weren't even directly mentioned in the 51-page document.
That's the BBC News. Now for a look at the morning papers. And the family of the murdered Conservative MP Sir David Amess have told the Sunday Times that they have been catastrophically failed by the government's de-radicalisation programme. Speaking in their first interview since Sir David was stabbed to death in October 2021, they say they've been told by the police that his killer was dropped from the Prevent scheme because of an admin error. The family's now calling for a public inquest to investigate the role of officials in the period before his murder. The Sunday Telegraph says more than 1,600 bosses have closed their companies this month ahead of Wednesday's budget amid what the paper calls widespread concern that the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will put up capital gains tax. It says the number of closures is by far the highest of the year and more than double the figure for last October. In an interview with The Observer, Ms Reeves says her budget will match the greatest economic moments in Labour's history by launching a new era of public and private investment in hospitals, schools, transport and energy. With the headline, Gareth cleared to get gong, The Sun on Sunday says the former England football manager Gareth Southgate is in line for a knighthood in the New Year's Honours List after an investigation into his finances found no evidence of wrongdoing. The paper says Southgate was among hundreds of high-profile clients who put money into a controversial scheme to finance films, and HMRC has now ruled he did not benefit from reduced tax bills as a result of his investment. The Cabinet Office says it would be inappropriate to comment on potential honours recipients. The Sunday Mirror previews a two-part television documentary to be broadcast this week, in which Prince William says his personal crusade to end homelessness is inspired by his mother. The heir to the throne says Princess Diana started talking to him about the issue when he was very small, and he now does the same with his children on the school run. The paper features a number of previously unseen images, including a photograph of Prince William, aged 11, playing chess with a man at a homelessness charity that he visited with his mother in 1993. The launch of a campaign aimed at educating young drinkers on how to approach a busy pub bar is featured by the Sunday Telegraph. Beneath the headline, Can Someone Tell Gen Z How to Order a Pint? It says people who began to drink socially during the pandemic tend to wait in a single line to place their order, as they maintain habits originally designed to ensure social distancing. The Telegraph suggests the answer for senior drinkers is to jump the queue, asking, if elders don't know better at the boozer, what is the point of us? And that's our look at the Sunday papers. And just a reminder that British summertime ended during the night and the clocks have gone back 1 hour. That means it's now 7:10.
Alan Smith. Time now on Radio 4 for Sunday with Julie Etchingham.
Thanks very much. Good morning and welcome to Sunday. The Pope says it's a gift to the world, but the conclusion to the Church's mammoth listening exercise has left some progressive Catholics deeply disappointed. Also on the programme, how faith groups are supporting prisoners on early release.
A lot of these people that do end up getting released really early, they still need the support. You're just going to see them back round again because they've not received that support which they need.
If you've been involved in supporting people who've been released from prison, we'd like to hear from you. With Islamophobic incidents hitting an all-time high, why not all mosques are applying for government funding for their security? And why the nuns on the bus are going round and round ahead of the US election?
So just going into the bus now, up the steps.
Here I meet two of the bus riders.
My name is Sister Erin McDonald. We're encouraging people to be multi-issue voters, recognizing that we as human beings are complex.
Your emails to sunday at bbc.co.uk, and we're also on social media at bbcr4sunday. The most highly anticipated gathering at the Vatican since the 1960s ended last night. It was the culmination of a mammoth exercise called the Synod on Synodality, which began 3 years ago. More than a billion Catholics around the world were invited to feed in their ideas for reform in the Church. But it seems those who are hoping for change on thorny issues like women deacons or LGBT plus outreach are going to be disappointed with the final document which the Pope endorsed last night. He called it a gift to the world. Well, Austin Ivory, who's been involved at Synod deeply and is also Pope Francis' biographer, joins us from Rome now. Morning to you, Austin. Good morning. You were in the room when the document was endorsed and Pope Francis spoke. What was it like?
It was actually an amazing moment. I mean, this is the second of 2 month-long assemblies. We had one last October, and now this is the end of the second one. So we're at the end of a 3-year journey. We have a document which was voted on paragraph by paragraph, clear majorities. The Pope stands up, gives a very brief speech in which he essentially says, I recognise this document as the voice of the Church. The Spirit has spoken to the Church. You know, I recognise, go and do it. This is the first time he's done it like that. There was huge applause in the room. I'd say enormous genuine joy in the room. And it was a very exciting and, I dare say, historic moment.
You will know and you will have heard already, though, that there are those expressing disappointment with the absence of progress on women deacons, LGBT plus outreach, which barely got a mention in the 51-page document. What's your response to that? There are going to be a lot of people that will have thought, you know, I've fed in very heartfelt views to this enormous process and there just hasn't been the movement.
Yeah, well, people, of course, have been disappointed from the very beginning of this process that it hasn't been dealing with the things that they think it should be dealt with or coming up with the solutions that they believe the Church should come up with. What I can tell you, having been part of this from the very beginning, is that it has been a very sincere attempt to listen to the voice of people across the world. And remember, this is a global church present across the world, indeed, mostly now in Africa, Asia, Latin America. And having studied so many of the documents that came out of the listening processes in all those places, I can tell you there were certain things that came through all those documents that the people of God, as it were, wanted looked at. And they were looked at. And the question of women, for example, which I know is leading the headlines at the moment. One of the things that appeared in all those documents was, look, you know, women need to have greater recognition in the Church. The Spirit's pouring out gifts on them which need to be better recognised.
But there are a lot of women, forgive me, Austin, a lot of women who want more than that. There have already been 2 examinations of this issue under Pope Francis. He's put it back now to another examination next year. There'll be a lot of women who just feel they aren't being listened to in this listening process.
No, what there have been 2 commissions on is looking at a very, very specific question, which is access of women to the female diaconate. And that was never something that came from the consultation of the people. It was a proposal in some places to be looked at, indeed, and it will continue to be looked at, and that was said in the document last night. The commission remains open, but actually the question is stuck on various questions, which I won't go into. But just look at what the document did say about women in general. It said the women continue to encounter obstacles in having a fuller recognition of their charisms, vocations and roles. This is to the detriment of the Church's mission. The document calls for the full implementation of all the opportunities, you know, provided for in regard to women. There's no reason, it says, there's no impediment that should prevent women from carrying out leadership roles in the Church. What comes from the Holy Spirit cannot be stopped. Very, very clear message there to the whole Church, which is to say, you know, if there's obstacles to women exercising charism ministries, they should be dealt with.
Only a passing reference also to the LGBT plus community. Again, there will be families that will have committed their personal stories to that process that will be disappointed on that front.
Except that the document, it was never about these particular issues. The document was, the name of the whole process is the Synod on Synodality. Yeah. How the Church becomes more synodal, as to say, how it uses consultation, participation in decision-making, discernment processes in order to proceed. It's about a conversion in the way we operate. Now, of course, a big part of that is a conversion, and there's a whole section dedicated to a conversion of the way we relate to each other. And there is a lot in the document, you know, about a church that is welcoming, inclusive, that learns to listen, that learns to walk with people. And indeed, people, sexual differences and so on, are all in there. But no, it doesn't go into these topics in great detail, because this was always going to be, this final document, focus on the really quite narrow but vital question of how the Church becomes synodal. And we have all kinds of things in here, calls for mandatory, you know, parish councils, calls for ecclesial assemblies at all sorts of levels. This is the biggest change in the way the Catholic Church operates in a generation. It's a hugely important step forward.
Austin Ivory, I think you're heading to the Papal Mass later. Very good to speak to you this morning. Thank you very much indeed. Now, one of the many fallouts from the October 7th attacks is the big rise in reports of religious hate. Tell Mama, the organisation which has been monitoring Islamophobic incidents, has recorded a more than 300% increase in the past year. For many Muslims, a visit to the mosque now has a sense of trepidation, even fear. The government has allocated around £60 million to protect faith communities over the next 4 years. Almost half of that is for mosque security and Muslim faith schools. But many mosques are apparently unaware of the support or unable to access the funding. So what's behind this? Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Usman Chowdhury, a trustee from Cheadle Mosque in Stockport, and Mick Diversi from the Muslim Council of Britain. Thank you both very much indeed, gentlemen, for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Dr. Usman Chowdhury, I'll come to you first. Your mosque is a real community hub, isn't it, where the fears and the threats have been very real. Just tell me what it's been like in the last 12 months.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you very much. I mean, certainly since the Southport attacks, around that time, we had a real fear, something I've never really felt before about going to the mosque. There were threats that the far right were going to come to the mosque and protest outside and create trouble, essentially. And it was really quite a shock in that the tide, you know, from a kind of quite a cohesive community, really, within a matter of days, tired of change, where it seemed to be okay to be Islamophobic, okay to post, you know, a variety of hate messages on social media, or come to the mosque and attack it.
Sorry, do go on.
Yeah, so a real fear, and I think, as you mentioned before, Tell Mama have reported, I think earlier on this year, about a 600% increase in rise of Islamophobia. And that's always been there. I mean, at the mosque over years, you know, I've been assaulted on locking the mosque on one occasion. Windows have been smashed. Graffiti has been daubed. It's a good community, but there are, unfortunately, you know, individuals who do propagate this hate. So funding like this is very welcome, but there has been difficulties in accessing. It's been a very kind of protracted process.
Well, yes, I was going to ask you actually what the process has been like, because I know that you have been one of the mosques that has actually applied to this fund. What is the process like?
So my colleagues have gone through some of the forms, and we started, I think our first application was about 2.5 years ago. So it's quite a technical form that my colleagues tell me about. It took quite some time to go through it. And that first application was unsuccessful. We did apply again later, and we were able to secure some support for a CCTV system, a part support. And then we've applied again since, and that was perhaps at the end of last year, the start of this year, and we haven't heard back. And I think speaking to other mosques, sometimes because the form is quite difficult, is very technical, some have struggled at that first step. Others have applied and haven't been successful, and therefore just haven't, you know, tried again further.
Yeah, and you did have some emergency support, didn't you, after the Stockport, after the Southport murders?
We did, and we're very grateful the Home Office did step up. I think they provided this immediate emergency support of some security guards, which actually just finished about 3-4 days ago. It was gratefully received. However, there wasn't really a consultation about how that support and security guards could be used. In fact, the first we knew of them coming, they just turned up on the day, and we struggled to find out who'd sent them and where they come from. Okay. And sometimes when you email the Home Office, I know they're busy, but respectfully, there was no response, no reply. So. Grateful, but perhaps it could have been used more effectively.
Okay, Dr. Chowdhury, thank you very much indeed for that insight. I'll turn to Mick Diversi now. And just your understanding of this issue, why are some mosques and communities not applying for the funding? I mean, there are some complexities just around the fundamentals of actually getting the practical application in. One report suggesting around 300 of a possible 2,000 mosques have applied for support. Do all of them know it's actually available, do you think? Is there a communication problem here?
Good morning. Yes, that's exactly right. I think there are three levels of challenge here. The first of which, as you rightly state, is that many don't even know it exists. There's not really much of a marketing activity. These are hard to reach communities. These are communities who generally aren't engaging very much with government. And there's not really much of an outreach. So that's step one, that most don't even know about it. Of those who do know about it, there's suspicion about it. There are worries that this will mean that the Home Office will be coming into their mosques. They'll have greater scrutiny in what they do, which they don't think is necessarily relevant, that it's linked to the Prevent scheme. There are lots of these concerns, some of which have elements of fact in them and some of them which don't. Again, that needs to be a hurdle that needs to be overcome. And the third layer is as was mentioned here, even those who do know about it, even those who don't think there are any suspicious challenges there, they then have an issue because they find it difficult to actually apply, because the form is not straightforward. It requires certain things to be done. And for example, the type of support you get may not be what they're looking for, and you may have to put some money in yourself, which they may not be able to afford. So there are lots of these challenges that have made it quite difficult. And we've been raising these challenges for a long time, highlighting why people have not been applying. And now it's good that more have been applying, a few hundred who have applied this time. But it's still significantly lower than it should be. And that's because structurally it's not set up for success. And I think that those challenges, which have been highlighted by many Muslim institutions, we took a whole big survey out right when the last thing came out, again, need to be overcome for this to be success.
So what model would work then? There have been some suggestions that the Jewish community has the Community Security Trust, which is at one step removed from the Home Office, and an independent way of channeling some of the funding. Is that a model that would be attractive to you?
A model like that could be quite attractive. I think the fundamental has to be an approach which thinks about how you can reach these hard-to-reach communities. It's possible to be done without an independent structure, or it could be done with an independent structure, but with significant thought about how to deal with these identified problems. It doesn't have to be one way or the other.
Okay.
But you can't ignore the problems that are there. Okay. Noting that on an underlying basis, there's a massive underreporting of Islamophobia, which means the problem is even larger than the government is understanding right now.
Miqdad Versi from the Muslim Council of Britain, Dr. Usman Chowdhury, thank you both very much indeed for that. With the most consequential and divisive US election in living memory entering its final furlong, there's one part of the campaigning you might have missed. It's a big blue tour bus which has been crisscrossing America with a group of religious sisters on board. They are called, what else? The Nuns on a Bus. They say they're not party political, aiming to dissuade Catholics and non-Catholics alike from voting on single issues like abortion. Their emphasis is on protecting democracy, and they've drawn up what they call an equally sacred checklist of freedoms, including the freedom from harm and the freedom to be healthy. Tara Godomsky has been to meet them.
It's a busy day here on the campus of Marywood University in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And in the middle of it all, getting a few second looks from the students as they rush past, is a bright tour bus. It's painted blue, and on each side are these beautiful paintings of diverse human beings. There's also an American flag painted brightly on the bus. This is the vehicle that is transporting the organization called Nuns on the Bus across the United States. And they're here in Scranton today to hold a town hall and speak with the community about the upcoming elections. Okay. And the driver has just turned off the bus so we can have a better sounding interview. Thank you for that. So just going into the bus now, up the steps.
All right.
Here I meet two of the bus riders.
My name is Sister Erin McDonald. I am a sister of St. Joseph, and I live and work in Detroit, Michigan.
I'm Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson. I'm President and CEO of Children's Defense Fund.
Nuns on the Bus is a project of the nonpartisan advocacy group called Network, which was founded by Catholic sisters in 1972. This is the group's eighth time on the road, and for the first time includes friends, that is, multi-faith leaders and secular groups.
In some cities, there's a public rally. In some cities, we're hosting a more town hall where it's a smaller crowd. And then we also have site visits and roundtable events where us as Network, Nuns on the Bus and Friends, are really just listening and figuring out how together as community we can advocate for a community that is thriving.
We're finding very different types of groups, but finding alignment in the values that people actual desire for their communities.
A big goal of the Nuns on the Bus and Friends tour is to encourage people to be multi-issue voters. Mm-hmm. Can we unpack that a little bit?
Absolutely. Okay. We're encouraging people to be multi-issue voters, recognizing that we as human beings are complex, that we are on a day-to-day basis, we are dealing with multiple issues, childcare and paying medical bills, access to education and jobs. So it's important that we're helping folks to embrace the idea of being a multi-issue voter.
On your website, there's the equally sacred checklist. What's missing from this checklist are things that you would traditionally think of the Catholic Church being hot button political issues, specifically abortion and same-sex marriage.
The issues that we're outlining are the issues that Network has historically always worked with and focused on. So abortion has not been a part of the Network platform. As people of faith, we have to be looking at talking about all of the issues that affect the sacredness of life.
Is this allowed? Is a Catholic allowed to say it's okay to not just think about abortion when voting?
As a Catholic sister, I'm saying that people of faith need to consider a multitude of equally sacred issues that impact all communities, that we are, as Catholics, called to care for all of God's creation.
You are a nonpartisan organization, and that's very, very important to your work. However, the aims that you have on your equally sacred checklist do tend more towards a Democrat or a liberal or a progressive type of voter.
I think context is helpful. The Catholic social teaching that informs Network's decision about positions is grounded in a context that is wider than a bipartisan political alignment. And the gospel that it is grounded and rooted in is deeper and longer history than that political alignment.
A short time later, about 150 people gather at the town hall here. The evening starts with prayer. Then six of the bus riders tell stories from their own communities to highlight what they call the equally sacred freedoms.
I am here to talk with you about the freedom to participate in a vibrant democracy.
And I'm going to talk about the freedom to be healthy.
We deserve the freedom to care for ourselves and our families.
I want to talk to you about the freedom of no harm.
At the town hall are several people who came to express their thoughts on abortion, like Jessica Frayne from Scranton.
The primary issue for me is really the protection of all human beings, especially in the womb, because they're the ones that don't have a voice. I think that if we could finally end this barbaric abortion issue, we could really work on all of these really important issues that I think many of us on the left and the right and red and blue really agree on.
And most people I speak to heed Sister Erin's call to remain hopeful through Election Day and beyond.
Do you mind if I just get your name?
Peter Pearson. I think they're actually bringing out the best in people without being partisan and figuring out a way to talk about the issues without demonizing anybody, which is pretty rare right now in politics in the United States.
Bryn Carey.
Samantha Mitchell.
And you're both Marywood students?
Yes.
I was really interested in seeing how Catholic identity was involved with politics.
I like getting different people's points of view. I like staying optimistic.
And the night ends with an invitation to commemorate the Nuns and Friends stop in Scranton, Pennsylvania, by signing the Big Blue Bus.
Thank you.
And on it rolls. Well, that report from Tara Godomsky. Next week, Edward Sturton will be live in Atlanta, Georgia, looking at all the religious issues with a special program ahead of the US election. The time is 7:30. Still to come, ahead of next month's vote in Parliament on assisted dying, we hear the diverse views within faith communities. The images of prisoners being released early from jail will be some of the most memorable of the early days of the new government, a bid to address extreme overcrowding, part of the legacy of their predecessors. Another 1,100 were let out this week. It may have temporarily relieved that pressure, but now it puts it on the probation service and those trying to support prisoners on their release, including a network of prison chaplains on the inside and in the community. So what role are chaplains' playing in this process. I spoke to one female ex-offender about her faith experience on the inside and out.
It was kind of like scary because you don't really know what you're going to be experiencing. So you're coming across various people with various different offences, whether that's drugs, whether that's fraud, or whether that's higher offences.
And what part did your faith play at that point?
When you're out in the community, you don't really practice your faith because either you're too busy with day-to-day life. But when you're in prison, you're on your own. That's what you can turn to. You're just talking to yourself and God, and that's literally what's going to keep you going sometimes. But obviously on the outside, I had my faith. But before I went inside, I've lost it. But then it was through the chaplaincy and then the support, like the Muslim Women in Prison project, that kind of like brought me back to faith.
And what sort of support did they offer you after you came out of prison?
The Muslim Women in Prison project is like a resettlement project. So even though it starts in the prison, they kind of still support you on the outside as well. I'm going to education. So I've done 6 level 2 qualifications, got a place at university. For me personally, it's that guidance that I needed and support that I needed to be on the right path and not go astray.
And how did your community react when you came out? How were you treated?
I think there's a lot of stigma and a lot of shame behind it, especially when a female Muslim goes into custody. It's because a lot of the family and a lot of the community start disowning you. If a male goes into custody, the family will easily just accept them back. But if it's a female, it's a bit difficult because the female carries the family name. So for me personally, it was that trying my best to stay in the same community as well.
I just wonder what your reflection is. We've seen these images of the prisoners on early release. What have you been thinking about when you've seen those images?
It's a good thing because it's kind of reducing the overcrowdedness of the prison. But a lot of these people that do end up getting released really early, they still need the support. So if you're releasing them early without the support, you're just going to see them back around again because they've not received that support which they need, whether that's mental health, whether that's housing.
The experience of one female ex-offender who was speaking to me earlier. Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Sophia Bunsey, Director of the Muslim Women in Prison Project, and Jackie Oglethorpe, who is Chair of Trustees at the Community Chaplaincy Association. Good morning to both of you. Dr. Bunsey, I'll come to you first. It's really interesting hearing that particular personal experience. How has your work and the work of chaplains been impacted by this early release scheme?
Morning, Julie. I think as with yourselves, we understand that the early release scheme has been actioned. It's a very reactionary decision to the overcrowding within prisons. But on the same note, we also understand that the third sector and the charity community sector plays quite a vital role in the resettlement of those prisoners. So although at the moment the conversation appears to be between the prison service and probation service on release, who are legally responsible for the well-being of these individuals as they pass through the prison gate, there is a role for the third sector. And, you know, we found in our experiences, community-based interventions are very effective in getting prisoners into a more fulfilling and productive lifestyle. I think there's...
What sort of things do you do for them? What sort of examples could you give us of that?
So there's a variance of examples. Imminent needs upon release are housing, financial support by way of benefits. But as those primary needs are met, we find that we support women with mental and emotional health. If we're alluding to the interviewee that was speaking, there's a lot of peripheral support in terms of facilitating faith support and then moving women on to more productive lifestyles in terms of volunteering, employment, housing support. So there's a number of things that we do to reintegrate. And quite often our support is quite flexible.
Forgive me, I was also intrigued by the issue that our ex-offender I spoke to raised, this issue of stigma, that it can be harder for women specifically on release. Forgiveness is not always a given in their communities, it might seem. Some communities have very deep concerns and don't grant them that.
That's more of a cultural notion and in many parts a... a patriarchal notion that women, as the interview alluded to, women quite often carry the family name, and it is deemed culturally that when there is a level of dishonour that's brought to the family name.
And how are you helping the women to navigate that? It's a real challenge, isn't it, for them?
Of course it is. And I think education is a main key. And, you know, as you're aware, we were the first outfit in the country in 2013 to write about the issue of Muslim women coming through the criminal justice system. And within that comes community education and more awareness around this, because as we're aware, every faith, including the Abrahamic faiths, grant forgiveness, and there's a real sense of absolution within those faiths. So actually we've used faith as a tool to mitigate some of that malpractice around the duality of treatment of men and women.
Sophia, thank you for that. Just turn to Jackie Oglethorpe now. And the Ministry of Justice has acknowledged, they send us a statement about this, the vital role that faith can play in helping offenders turn their lives around. They said to us that we work closely with a range of faith and belief-based organisations to support them as they re-enter the community. Has that been your experience in this specific time of early release?
Good morning, Julie. Yes, I mean, I think, yes, it has. But inconsistently across the country. I think the problem we have is that there is no consistency and there's no forward funding. So we are left in a position where we are often reliant on charitable donations to support some of the expertise and the work that's going on in the community.
And what sort of work do community chaplains do on the ground, and how do they bridge that moment between those who are coming out of prison and trying to rehabilitate themselves?
I think it's important to say that we are a small organisation in relative standards. So we have about 32 faith-based organisations across the country, all doing very different things, but all with something at their heart, which is central. The common denominator is that whilst they may be from multi-faith backgrounds, different faiths, they, as Sophia said, we're all practising forgiveness and hope. The thought of being persevering and holding on to a future that is positive for a lot of these prison leavers who at a time in their lives often do not have that hope. We carry it for them.
But what are you hearing from the communities, perhaps, into which the prisoners are being released? There'll be very many people listening will be thinking, oh, that's a great way to support prisoners on early release. But the communities into which they're being released may not feel quite the same way. They may feel frightened. They may feel they may have very many questions about who is being released into their midst.
And I think one of the key words that comes out from that is education. I think we are misinformed a lot of the time by what is going on. The reality is that many, many people in prison are imprisoned for non-violent offences. Over 61% of the prison population is there because of non-violent offences. And what we need is to be able to assist communities and those who are coming out of prison to be linked together. And I think the problem is that the links are weak at certain times. And as lots of people have said, if you do early release, then you just put more pressure on the people in the community. And we need to ensure that all the links are strong.
Jackie Oglethorpe, thank you very much indeed. And Dr. Sophia Buncey too. Thank you. Followers of one of the most influential and controversial figures in the Catholic Church have been mourning his death this week. Gustavo Gutierrez was regarded as the father of liberation theology. Rooted in his native Latin America, he argued that the Church should actively side with the poor and push for structural change to help them. It was too much for some in the Church, not least Pope John Paul II, who feared it was too political, too close to Marxism. Dr. Jörg Rieger, Professor of Theology at the Vanderbilt Divinity School in Nashville, Tennessee, knew Father Gustavo. I asked him what he was like.
He was probably one of the kindest persons that you can imagine. A lot of people think he's the father of liberation theology, and therefore he would have had to have this fierce presence, but he was very kind, gentle person. I really saw him as a mentor for many years. I first met him in Lima, where he had spent most of his life and worked in the early 1990s. It's left a mark on my life.
His book in 1971, A Theology of Liberation, coined that term. It grew out of his interpretation of Christianity in the context of Latin America. Why did it cause such a seismic shake through the church?
What a lot of people don't know is that at the same time, the term liberation was actually used in various parts around the world independently of each other. So before Father Gutierrez published his book in the United States, James Cone had published a Black Theology of Liberation in the fall of 1970. And I think this is what's behind liberation theology going global so quickly, that it actually had these roots in different places.
The concept that he embraced and those who then came to follow it embraced too was this deep belief that the church needed to be actively on the side of the poor, to actively push for political structural change, and that's what brought him into such controversy.
That is correct. So what happened here really was this understanding that the church cannot stay out of it. The church cannot stay on the sidelines. That's one way of looking at to say the church has to get involved. The other side of that, of course, was the realization that the church was always involved, just on the wrong side. So what they realized after a while was to say, you know, the church is not innocent here. The church is actually, and it has been for too long, on the side of the powerful, on the side of the wealthy. And so by turning this around, what they realized was not only that there was a different task for the church, but it had to do with their theology, and theology he really means their understandings of God.
But I suppose it's because this theology was aligned to the politics of Latin America. It became aligned to those politics so firmly in some quarters, which made it problematic. I mean, one of his adherents, the Brazilian Archbishop Helder Camara, I mean, he put his finger on it in that famous quote, didn't he? When he said, "When I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why they're poor, they call me a communist." Pope John Paul II was deeply concerned about priests in places like Nicaragua who were inspired by liberation theology, actively part of the Sandinista revolution in Nicaragua.
The big concern that they always voiced was, well, there's Marxism involved, there's socialism involved. But that was the problem, because in a way, the option for the poor was connected, of course, to the Bible, to images of God, but also to some political options that were non-capitalist, that were looking for viable alternatives.
But how did he react to being under investigation by none other than Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, later Pope Benedict, of course? I mean, what impact did that have on him?
This was difficult, no question about it. I mean, these were difficult times, because what was at stake wasn't just a disagreement. But more importantly, the question was always, what will happen to the people if we do not follow, their liberation, if we do not work for their benefits? So for Father Gutierrez, I think this was one of the big struggles. So less about just his own personal fortunes, but what is going to happen?
He gradually moved into an easier era under Pope Francis. Pope Francis was not originally a fan of liberation theology, was he? But slowly softened that and brought him back into the fold.
This is important because, as you say, you know, I mean, many people might not initially have been fans of liberation theology, especially, you know, if this is not the way you have been raised, if this is not the way you have been taught in seminary, in university. But what happened, I think, with Pope Francis and so many others, I mean, Oscar Romero, the Archbishop of El Salvador, is another example. They came from more conservative positions, but being with the people, being with the poor, in some ways transformed them. And of course, not just being with the poor in terms of social movements, but spiritually, you know.
Dr. Jörg Rieger there. With the first vote on the assisted dying bill a matter of weeks away, this week the Health Secretary Wes Streeting said he would vote against it. Few subjects will test as hard the conscience of politicians and the public alike. There may be a perception that those of faith are intrinsically opposed to it, based broadly on the concepts of thou shalt not kill and the sanctity of life. But there are diverse views within faith communities as they too grapple with the complexities of the debate. I'm joined now by Dr. Jonathan Romain, a Reform rabbi and chair of the Religious Alliance for Dignity in Dying, and Iqbal Nasim, an imam and educator whose mother is terminally ill. Iqbal Nasim, I'll come to you first. Thanks both for joining us on this morning. You're in the crux of caring for your dear mother who is suffering from pancreatic cancer. You and she absolutely opposed to the idea of assisted dying, and this is rooted deeply in your faith as Muslims.
Hi, good morning. Yes, that's right. She was diagnosed over a year ago, and at that time was told that she may have anywhere between 3 and 12 months left. Thankfully, so far, she's been defying all expectations. And we haven't yet entered into that most vulnerable period that is expected to come. But certainly, I think this is a time when she and we collectively are developing, I suppose, our mental and spiritual resilience in order to be able to encounter the last period with as much positivity, dignity, and hope as possible.
Can you understand why others of faith are struggling deeply with this? They may have witnessed a relative in agony who is longing for the end to their lives. There's a really profound question about compassion in this moment, whether it is right to prolong suffering potentially because we now have the medical ability to allow people to live longer.
Of course, I totally empathize with the arguments at hand, and it is a difficult issue. However, I do find it very difficult to square the support for assisted dying from certainly within the Abrahamic traditions. From our perspective, I mean, within the Muslim community, both in this country as well as globally, I think there's almost total unanimity on this issue. It's probably one of the few issues where we are almost completely united. And one of the ways to try to understand that is to appreciate that the way we see ourselves is as embodied souls, immortal souls, having a very, very temporary earthly experience. We look at life, and I know that a lot of Muslims draw strength from the fact that we look at life as a drop in the ocean of the hereafter. And there are verses in the Quran that refer to the fact that in hindsight, the entirety of our lives, long lives, will seem as though just a morning or an evening.
Let me take that thought, if I may, Iqbal Nasim, and speak then to Jonathan Romain. You've changed your position on this from having witnessed those in great suffering. Listening to Iqbal there, what would you say to him?
Well, I certainly understand that there are people opposed for all sorts of reasons. But the reason I, and not just me, but a lot of people of faith, as every single poll suggests, it's not just public support, but those with the faith, is for two reasons. Firstly, the practical. There are too many people dying every day in pain from horrible diseases, suffering. And at the moment, they don't have good options. They've only got bad options, either suffering on or trying to attempt suicide, which is horrible for them and their relatives, or going abroad to Switzerland. So it's not a great position, but there's a religious response as well, that if you see someone suffering, surely the compassionate response is to try and help them. Now, sanctity of life is important, but what does it mean? I mean, to me, it means using your own life as best as possible and respecting the life of others, but not suffering on when you are terminally ill and you want to let go. In other words, we're not shortening life, we're shortening death. And there's nothing sacred about suffering, nothing holy about agony, and it seems to me that the C word, compassion, is very important. And the religious response is to give people options. Now, I would suggest that actually Iqbal is perfectly able to say that he doesn't want it for himself and his mother, but we shouldn't prevent other people having that options. And it seems to me much more religious and humane to give people options of saying, carry on in pain, or go for palliative care, or have assisted dying.
Well, let me put that directly to Iqbal. What about that question of choice that Dr. Romain raises there? How would you respond to that?
Well, from our perspective, see, the issue of compassion needs to be weighed up against other values of patience, of hope, of trust, of redemption. I think when we see the purpose of life as sanctifying and purifying one soul, it's also important to appreciate the way in which we see pain and suffering as ways of us turning fully to God. It's often in these moments that people turn to God, even find God. It would be odd, I think, in that perspective and in the perspective of an eternity in which we hope to be in the company of God, to have made our last decision one of possible despair and a possible rejection of God's decree, as opposed to a patient endurance with the hope of purification and redemption.
Jonathan Romain, what would you say to that?
Well, that was very eloquent, but essentially Iqbal is imposing his view on people, either Muslims who have a different view, or on Christians and Jews, or on people of no faith. And really, it just seems to me much more, I mean, who's the more compassionate? The person who says, you've got to do it my way, or who says, you have your own life and your own death, and we all want to live as life as well as possible. Should we not also have the option of dying as well as possible? And it's a real problem. This hasn't come out of nowhere. It's only arisen because so many people are dying in pain. Plus, and here's the key thing, that other countries have found a solution, such as Oregon, which is what the British law that's intended will be modelled on, where they've been doing this for 25 years. In other words, it's not a step into the dark. There's a quarter of a century's worth of experience, and where it's really worked very well.
But Dr. Romain, just to interject there, I mean, it is the complexities of the legal challenge which some are flagging very seriously. There are very many individual cases that one might be able to quote when arguing in favour of assisted dying, but can any law really take into context the full panoply of human experience? Each case is nuanced and complex, and that's one of the reasons people with faith and without faith are raising serious questions about this.
Oh, it's certainly true. We have to get the law right. But we've got the ability to build on the experience of every other country who's done it. And there are different ways of doing it. I personally feel that the bill that Kim Ledbetter is introducing has got these really strong red lines. You have to be terminally ill. You have to be mentally competent. You have to want it of your own free will. And that's what seems to work. People are worried, then they should suggest ways of improving that rather than just having an ideological opposition. Let's try and help people. That's what it's all about.
Iqbal, just a quick final comment from you on this.
I'm just worried that once the Overton window shifts on this, that the possibilities of abuse, of coercion, of the cultural pressure on people to end their lives prematurely, the slippery slope arguments do bear out when you look at other examples around the world, such as in the Netherlands, in Belgium.
Iqbal Nassim and Dr. Romain. And that is it for this week. If you'd like to comment on today's programme, you can email us at sunday@bbc.co.uk. You can listen again or download the programme as a podcast from the BBC Sounds app. And you can follow the programme on social media. Just search for BBCR4Sunday, all one word. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Sunday was produced by Dan Tierney and Katie Davis. And now the TV presenter Amma Latif makes the Radio 4 appeal on behalf of Sense International.
I was 4 when doctors told my parents I had an incurable eye condition. It's called retinitis pigmentosa, and at some point I would be blind. At 18 years old, I woke up one morning and I couldn't see. Of course, it was such a devastating experience for me. But I had so much support around me and I was able to adapt. Being blind has never stopped me from achieving any of my goals in life. And that's why I'm supporting Sense International today. It helps children in countries including Peru, Kenya and India who are deaf or blind, or both, known as deaf blindness. Children like Lovely from Mumbai. She was born in 2016 with rare and complex needs. With no eyes, she couldn't see. Facial disfigurement meant she found it hard to move her lips and tongue, so she couldn't speak or cry. Doctors didn't know how to treat her, and unable to communicate or interact, Lovely spent much of her infanthood scared and clinging to her mum. But age 6, the local children's centre referred Lovely to Sense International. A support worker, Kuldeep, began visiting Lovely at home twice a week. Kuldeep gave Lovely physiotherapy, and best of all, they played together. Lovely loved the feel of soft sensory toys, and they sang joyful poems and nursery rhymes. Through music and play, she thrived. Lovely was taught the alphabet and how to use Braille, and before long, she was having lessons with a learning assistant. Lovely is now 8, and her parents say that the change in her has been remarkable. She can speak in sentences, recognise different people from their voices, and loves asking questions about the world around her. And this is why Sense International wants to help more children just like her. £10 could help pay for a set of sensory toys to be used in play therapy. And £50 could help pay for a support worker for a child for 6 months. To donate, just search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to Sense International and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. That's the whole address. And importantly, please mark the back of your envelope, Sense International. Thank you.
Amma Latif. Calls are free from landlines and mobiles, and all the details for giving online are there if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. And if you're a UK taxpayer and want Sense International to collect the gift aid on your donation, do include an email or postal address so that they can send you a gift aid declaration. Now for Sunday's weather forecast, here's Matt Taylor.
Thank you very much, John. A bit of a chilly start to Sunday for many of us. A touch of frost in one or two rural areas, but for some, a beautiful day ahead, especially if you're in Channel Islands, southern England, East Anglia, the Midlands, South and East Wales. There is just one or two areas of cloud around at the moment. That will break up, but plenty of sunshine through the day ahead once the mist and fog has cleared, and light winds too, so feeling quite pleasant in the sunshine we have. To north and west of Wales, northern England and eastern Scotland, a sunny morning here, but through the afternoon, we'll start to see a bit more cloud develop. And by the end of the afternoon and into the evening, the cloud could thicken up to bring some outbreaks of rain, a drizzle. For Western Scotland, Northern Ireland and the Isle of Man, we've had some morning sunshine so far. Just one or two showers in the north and west of Scotland. They'll temporarily fade, but already rain creeping into the west of Northern Ireland. That breaks of rain will become more extensive through the morning and into the afternoon, become heavy, spreading into western Scotland too, with it a strengthening wind. Temperatures across the UK for most today around 10 to 13 Celsius, at the highest though in southern England 14 to 16. Through tonight, breezy, cloudy and wet conditions will spread across all parts of the UK. Initial dip in temperature into single figures, but it will rise through the night into the low, if not mid-teens for some, as we see that cloud and outbreaks of rain spread across the country. It does mean for Monday, a much greyer day for many, quite misty and murky around hills and coasts. Outbreaks of rain or drizzle coming and going. Some will stay dry, best of any brighter breaks to the east of high ground. And given the clock change last night, worth reminding you that it's an earlier sunset tonight, around 20 past 4 in Shetland. Just after 10 past 5 in the Isles of Scilly.
Matt Taylor at the Weather Centre. Adam Fleming will be our host for Broadcasting House at 9, and he's here now. Adam.
Morning. So it's Rachel Rees's first budget on Wednesday. It's Halloween on Thursday, and the papers have not been able to resist a little spooky roundup about what the potential tricks or treats might be. We've also not been able to resist it either, so we're going to go for that gimmick too. I've also had an amazing conversation with this guy who's got verbal dyspraxia, which means he has to rely on a computer to speak. And the old voice was pretty horrible and he didn't like it, but he's had a massive upgrade and he is just so happy about it now, and he sounds great. And of course, we'll have the weekly paper review. We'll be joined by the commentator Marianne Seacart, Sam Lister from The Express, and Helen Lederer, who was in a very famous 90s sitcom, but I can guarantee you it'll be absolutely fabulous.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 27th of October. Good morning, this is Alan Smith. The Chancellor says her budget on Wednesday will be for the strivers. Israel has denied that its airstrikes on Iran avoided oil facilities because of American pressure. And the King is to resume a full schedule of overseas trips as he continues his cancer treatment. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says she will deliver a budget for the strivers this week. Writing in The Sun on Sunday, Ms Reeves says she will take an iron grip on the country's finances, but ensure Britain's working people are better off. The Conservatives say the budget is shaping up to be a nightmare for the British public. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Rachel Reeves is blunt. Not everything is going to be easy, she writes. The Chancellor is preparing to raise the amount businesses pay in employer national insurance contributions. That's despite allegations from Conservatives. It breaks Labour's manifesto promise not to increase taxes on working people. Ms Reeves denies that, saying it will be a budget for the strivers, and insists her decisions on tax will be tough but fair. Ms Reeves is also to change how debt is measured to allow more borrowing for infrastructure projects. There are warnings that could keep interest rates higher and mortgages more expensive. But as well as releasing more money for housing, schools and energy projects, the government is expected to announce in the coming days some of that extra spending will be used for a programme to rebuild hospitals. Addressing those on NHS waiting lists or being taught in crumbling classrooms or who can't afford a home, the Chancellor writes, "I've got your back."
The Chancellor's spending commitments will include a pledge to rebuild or refurbish 50 schools in England every year. More details from our education correspondent Hazel Shearing.
Rachel Reeves has promised £1.4 billion for the school rebuilding programme. The scheme, announced 4 years ago, aims to rebuild or refurbish about 500 schools in a decade. The BBC recently revealed that 23 schools have been completed and targets for hiring builders have been missed. The Treasury said the money represented a £550 million increase that would ramp up progress. But a teaching union said there was still a shortfall in funding for school buildings.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the targets of Israeli airstrikes on Iran on Friday night were not dictated by the United States. He was responding to suggestions that Israel had avoided attacking Iranian gas and oil facilities because of American pressure. Mr. Netanyahu said the targets were chosen in line with Israel's national interests. Sebastian Usher sent this report from Jerusalem.
The consequences of Israel's retaliatory attack on Iran are likely to depend on how much damage the airstrikes did to vital elements of Iran's military capability. But the fact that they don't appear to have been aimed at Iran's economic infrastructure or its nuclear facilities has potentially lessened the imperative Tehran may feel to further raise the stakes in the showdown with Israel. President Biden has said he hopes the cycle of escalation between the two countries may now end, but the implication that Israel yielded to American pressure on the choice of its target seems to have rankled the Israeli Prime Minister. Mr. Netanyahu has not yet given a public address since the attack on Iran, but his office moved quickly, not only to insist that Israel's choice of targets was entirely its own decision, but also to dismiss a media report that it had given Iran advance notice of the attack.
The Electoral Commission in Georgia says the parliamentary election yesterday was won by the ruling party Georgian Dream. Pro-Western opposition parties have complained of voting irregularities. The election was seen as pivotal in determining whether Georgia aligns itself more closely with Europe and the West or with Russia. Steve Rosenberg reports from the capital, Tbilisi.
Georgia's increasingly authoritarian ruling party, Georgian Dream, is celebrating victory. Its founder, billionaire Bidzina Ivanishvili, said official results reflected the talent of the Georgian people. But the pro-Western opposition has cried foul, citing numerous reports of vote violations. Yesterday, video emerged of brazen ballot box stuffing. And there was violence, including at a polling station south of Tbilisi. There, an opposition party official was badly beaten when he went to investigate reports of vote rigging. During the campaign, Georgian Dream had claimed that the opposition would drag the country into a war with Russia. Critics of the ruling party accuse it of dragging Georgia away from the West and back into Russia's orbit.
The King is to return to a normal schedule of engagements next year after coping well with his tour of Australia and Samoa. A royal aide said the trip had been the perfect tonic for the King as he continued his cancer treatment. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
The tour of Australia and Samoa was the King's biggest test since his cancer diagnosis. Those working closely with him said the visit had lifted his spirits, mood and recovery. Although the King's cancer treatment is ongoing, a senior royal official said a full overseas tour programme was being planned for next year, as well as public engagements in the UK. The royal aide said the King was a great believer in mind, body and soul, that his sense of duty kept his mind and soul engaged, while doctors made sure his body was properly looked after. The king was said to have been completely unruffled by the protests in Canberra, believing free speech to be the cornerstone of democracy.
A month-long Vatican summit has ended with a call for women to be given more leadership roles in the Catholic Church. It stops short of saying that women should be allowed to become priests. A Catholic women's rights group described the final summit document as an insufficient and disappointing response. The Radio 2 presenter Johnny Walker hangs up his headphones today after nearly 60 years. He'll host his final episode of Sounds of the 70s 2 days after presenting The Rock Show for the last time. Earlier this month, he announced that at the age of 79, he was stepping down because of ill health. This report's from Nuananji.
Johnny Walker has been a fixture on BBC Radio for decades. He joined Radio 1 in 1969 and later joined Radio 2, where he has remained ever since. This afternoon, the broadcaster will host Sounds of the 70s for the last time, bringing his radio career to an end. He said it would be sad to say goodbye. He will be replaced on Sounds of the 70s by Bob Harris, while Sean Keaveney will be the new presenter of The Rock Show.
That's the BBC News. Now for a look at the papers. And the family of Sir David Amess have given their first interview since the Conservative MP was murdered in 2021, telling the Sunday Times they've been catastrophically failed after his killer was dropped from the government's de-radicalisation programme because of an admin error. Sir David's daughter, Katie Amess, claims it's pretty obvious that the Prevent scheme isn't fit for purpose. The paper argues that the family deserves full transparency, insisting a report on the killer's contact with Prevent should surely be released as part of efforts to prevent a repeat of the tragedy. The Mail on Sunday says Sir Keir Starmer has rejected Conservative claims that he's told a double lie by insisting this week's budget will not be a war on Middle Britain that breaks Labour's manifesto tax promises. Writing in the paper, the former Tory Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng acknowledges that his mini-budget in 2022 wasn't perfect, but warns that Wednesday will see the government declare naked class war. The stupidity of trying to distinguish between workers and investors in property and other assets, he says, is pure socialism. The Sun on Sunday responds to the Chancellor's description of her plans as a budget for the strivers by applauding her focus on low-wage workers. But it warns that creating growth to kickstart the economy is more difficult and suggests a Rwanda-style deterrent is needed to prevent migrants who cross the channel in small boats from blowing a financial hole in the government's plans. The Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson has told the Sunday Mirror that the tough decisions taken by the Chancellor will be worth it. The paper urges Rachel Reeves to lay the foundation for renewal, arguing short-term pain must be set against long-term gain. The two candidates vying to be the next Conservative leader have launched what the Sunday Telegraph calls their fiercest attacks of the campaign so far in interviews with the paper. It says Kemi Badenoch appeared to question Robert Jenrick's record by pointing out that she has never been sacked amid a whiff of impropriety in an apparent reference to her rival's involvement in a planning dispute when he was housing secretary. Mr. Jenrick is described as taking a swipe at the lack of policies set out by Mrs. Badenoch after he said Tory party members want a plan today rather than the promise of one tomorrow. And images of the King feature on several front pages after Buckingham Palace said he would return to a normal schedule of overseas trips next year. According to the Sunday Telegraph, the King's successful tour of Samoa and Australia has given royal officials renewed confidence that if he can visit somewhere so logistically challenging during cancer treatment, then he can go anywhere. The Sunday Express says it's excited by the development, arguing that appreciation, respect and love for Charles has deepened as he confronted cancer with dignity and bravery. That's our look at the papers. And just a reminder that British summertime ended during the night and the clocks have gone back 1 hour, meaning it's now 8:10.
Alan Smith. Now on BBC Radio 4, time for Sunday worship, which comes today from Marylebone in central London with the Southwell Consort. The service is introduced by the church's rector, Monsignor Philip Whitmore. The sound of holiness.
Thank you. welcome to St. James's Spanish Place. This church has been a place of Catholic worship since the late 18th century, and in fact we trace our history even further back than that to the chapel of the Spanish Embassy near here, where Mass could be celebrated at a time when it was forbidden elsewhere. Father Marcus Holden leads our meditation this morning.
In worship, we draw close to God, from whom all beauty arises. The holiness in God is given to us in the coming of Jesus Christ into our world. In his loveliness, we become beautiful by grace. Today, we reflect upon the holiness and beauty of God, and particularly upon its expression through music, the sound of holiness. As a priest in my parish and in my ministry, I see how the holiness of God reaches people through architecture, art, and especially music. There is something very wide and timeless about this. It reaches people from all ages and backgrounds. Our first hymn from John Monsell, one-time chaplain to Queen Victoria and prolific poet, is very fitting to this holy place and for our theme of reflection today. Oh, worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness.
Thank you.
from Isaiah chapter 6, beginning at the first verse. I saw the Lord seated on a high throne. His train filled the sanctuary. Above him stood seraphs, each one with six wings, two to cover its face, two to cover its feet, and two for flying. And they cried out one to another in this way, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Sabaoth. His glory fills the whole earth. The foundations of the threshold shook with the voice of the one who cried out, and the temple was filled with smoke. I said, What a wretched state I am in. I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have looked at the King, Lord Sabaoth. Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding in his hand a live coal, which he had taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. With this he touched my mouth and said, See now, this has touched your lips. Your sin is taken away. Your iniquity is purged.
As with Isaiah the prophet, the holiness of God is praised in the music of the angels in heaven and transmitted to us on earth, even in our unworthiness. From the earliest times of the church, Christians have sung of the beauty of God. This tradition was inherited from the hymn book of ancient Israel, the Psalms, where we are commanded, as in Psalm 68, sing to God, sing praises to his name, lift up a song to him who rides through the deserts. His name is the Lord, exalt before him. We know that Jesus Christ himself would have sung psalms in the temple and in prayer, as in Matthew 26, where we read, And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Drawn from this tradition and the sounds of other ancient cultures of converted Christians, distinct chants developed. Gregorian chant is the name given to one of these earliest traditions. It's named after Pope Gregory the Great, who contributed massively to the development of worship in the West. Gregorian chant was sung both to reflect the beauty of God, but also to implore the outpouring of holiness and grace, the gift of the Holy Spirit. When the first missionaries sent by Pope Gregory arrived in England in 597 AD, just before Pentecost, we're told that they were chanting. This Gregorian hymn, calling on the Holy Spirit, reminds us of that tradition and also of the work of the Holy Spirit in bringing the life of heaven into our souls.
Singing chant and polyphony is like singing with the harmonies of the universe. You can almost feel the planets turning around you whilst you're singing. And of course, at the centre of all this is God, who we come closer to when we sing in tune with all of his creation around us. It's sometimes hard to even keep singing and to not stop to feel the peace it brings into your soul.
I think the thing that is most beautiful about this music for me is that it puts the teachings through word painting and melodic line into a context that's accessible to everyone. As listeners, the congregation is left with no doubt that they're having a mystical experience, and the singers are forced to listen to each other in a way that brings us closer together and helps us understand that without each other, we can't create the beautiful whole.
singing Gregorian chant connects me to the monks of old who would sing daily for the Holy Mass and the Divine Office. Singing Polyphony connects me to the angels who sing in choirs, incessantly giving glory to God. Overall, I sing to elevate my mind and soul towards God, adoring and giving thanks to Him through my voice.
Sacred music has a long history and has helped countless people to draw close to the mystery of God through the centuries. But it remains a powerful channel of inspiration today. Sophie Bevan, MBE, takes principal parts in opera houses and concert halls here in the UK and across the world. But one of her particular loves is singing what is called the polyphonic or multi-part sacred music of the Renaissance. She, like others here, have been inspired by the glory of sacred music.
For me, church music has been what nurtured my love for music and gave me the inspiration for a career and life centered around singing. I am the eldest of seven, and as children, my parents sang the relevant Marian antiphon to us every night in bed, my siblings joining in one by one as soon as they were able, cobbling together the Latin by ear. Then, every weekend, we were packed into the car and made the long journey from Somerset to Chelsea, where my father was director of music and where my mother sang soprano for the Church of the Most Holy Redeemer and St. Thomas More. We were again encouraged to join in and follow the music from a very young age. I'll never forget the moment that I was quietly following along with my mum and she had to suddenly stop to attend to the baby and I carried on alone. When we finished a few bars later, everyone turned to me and exclaimed at my ability to hold the line for the first time. I was bursting with pride, and it was the start of what has become one of the main joys of my life, singing polyphony on a Sunday morning. As I grew older, my confidence and that of my siblings grew, and we were regularly picked by Dad for solos, all within the nurturing atmosphere of the organ loft at Holy Redeemer. Our voices matured, and for a few of us, we came to the realization that we were lucky enough to have been blessed with a gift that meant we could follow a vocational career using these gifts. Now, at the age of 40, and singing all over the place in various opera houses and concert halls, the one place that I most love to sing is at church, St. Borinus Church in Dorchester-on-Thames, where my husband, the conductor and composer Ryan Wigglesworth, and I run the music, along with my sisters Daisy and Tess and my cousins Francis and Dominic. It brings us back down to earth, but on the other hand, transcends all other music making we do, because we are doing it for love, not for money, and because the music is the most beautiful music of all to sing. Perhaps because that's where it all began for us. Simple Gregorian chant, the most ancient of all music, and 15th and 16th century polyphony. I feel closer to God and the angels singing this music than any other.
In my vision, I heard the sound of an immense number of angels gathered round the throne, and the living creatures and the elders. There were 10,000 times 10,000 of them, and thousands upon thousands, loudly chanting, "Worthy is the Lamb that was sacrificed to receive power, riches, wisdom, strength, honor, glory, and blessing." Then I heard all the living things in creation, everything that lives in heaven and on earth, and under the earth and in the sea, crying, "To the one seated on the throne and to the Lamb be all praise, honour, glory and power for ever and ever." And the four living creatures said, "Amen," and the elders prostrated themselves to worship.
The full vision of God is open to humanity by the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. The book of Revelation describes, with the best metaphors of the vision of John, the sound and holiness of the worship of heaven. Christian music through the ages preserved its original spiritual simplicity, but also began to develop in multifaceted ways to reflect the overwhelming richness of the vision of the holy. O Nata Lux is a piece by Thomas Tallis, who composed for the court of Queen Elizabeth I and for persecuted Catholics. It's described as polyphonic, as it gives an overlapping of voices to mirror, in a human cadence, the sound of the angels. It was written especially for recusant Catholics during times of persecution, and while there is sadness expressed, there is also the transformative vision of Jesus Christ at his transfiguration, the light born of light which enlightens us. We hear the supplication to receive holiness through becoming members of his body. In the Catholic writer J.R.R. Tolkien's book, Silmarillion, he speaks of a world being created through music. In this creation narrative of Middle-earth, God, who is called Ilúvatar, expansive in loving, chooses to share divine life, the flame imperishable, by creating other music makers, who can both participate in the eternal music, but also add new cadences. Some participate, others do not. But for those who freely do, either immediately or subsequently in repentance, something beautiful arises. Creation and providence in our world too can be described in these terms. Such insights into the beautiful have shaped the Christian understanding and worship. The need for music in praise has also been the backdrop for the development of broader culture, like a fruit of worship. The very language of music, musical notation, was developed in the monasteries. Guido of Arezzo is given the title of innovator of staff notation. The sound of chanting monks has accompanied the building of civilizations. The most fabulous edifices of medieval Christendom The great cathedrals and churches dotted throughout this land arose, in one sense, from sacred music and for sacred music. From the earliest records of Christian faith, we hear St. Paul say, "Be filled with the Spirit, addressing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody to the Lord with your heart." When Pliny the Younger described the early Christians, their distinctive features that mark them out, he says, "They sing songs to Christ as to a God." It is not surprising that an Augustinian tradition states, "The one who sings prays twice." We believe that God is transcendent and beyond our reach, and yet all that comes forth from God reflects in some way the truth of his eternal being. God is therefore all good and all beautiful. This is the holiness of God of which the scriptures speak. The startling claim of Christianity is that in Christ Jesus, the goodness and beauty of God, the holiness of eternity, become present and accessible to us. The whole of Christian life and worship can be described as drawing close to this holiness and being transformed by it. The call to be holy as I am holy is the call to be good and beautiful as I am good and beautiful. This revelation of holiness in goodness and beauty is supremely attractive. St. Augustine of Hippo reflected upon his famous conversion, writing, "Late have I loved you, beauty so ancient and so new. Late have I loved you. You called, shouted, broke through my deafness. You flared, blazed, banished my blindness. You lavished your fragrance. I gasped, and now I pant for you. I tasted you, and now I hunger and thirst. You touched me, and I burned for your peace." Ultimately, we only receive a full measure of this beauty in heaven, and that is why Christians often sing of heaven and see themselves as pilgrims on a journey there. We approach the celebration of All Saints at this time in the year, and we're reminded that they receive holiness from Christ. All that lights their souls comes from his light. The saints participate in that great song of the heavenly Jerusalem. The great British hymn tradition is one of the treasures of these isles. It's shared by many Christian churches and communions. The tradition is a development of chant using metrical musical patterns. The use of organs enables whole congregations to sing in unison. The tones are often drawn from chant, and as in the hymn to follow, Jerusalem the Golden, the words come from ancient motets and poems. Bernard of Cluny writes this poem about heaven, in which we participate on earth through our worship. It comes from his De Contemptu Mundi, on the contempt of the world, not a motif of despising the creation, but about not allowing what is worldly to prevent access to the heaven for which we were made. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Southwell Consort specializes in the tradition of English polyphony. Next weekend, they appear at the second annual St. Barinus Festival of Music within the context of Catholic liturgy in Dorchester on Thames. This next piece, the Media Vita, which you will hear as we make today our intercessions and prayers, was written by John Shepherd. Born in 1515 and died probably of flu in 1558, he lived through some of the most tumultuous religious times in our country's history. He suffered, and yet he keeps producing the music of holiness. This piece comes at the high point of his great tradition, and it speaks of the struggles of life, but also of the holiness of God, from which we gain strength. Holy God, holy mighty, holy and merciful Saviour. In the ancient Ambrosian Rite, these words were used for the litany of the saints on All Saints' Day. It reminds us to keep focused on the beauty of heaven, even in the midst of trials.
Approaching the thrice holy God, the holiest in the heights, we bring the needs of the Church and of the world.
As we approach the great Feast of All Saints, we pray for a new outpouring of holiness in our day, so that new saints may arise.
We pray for all people throughout the world, searching for real goodness and lasting light, that they may find what they seek in their faith.
We pray for all those who offer their natural gifts and inspired talents to the beautifying of the Church on earth and her worship. We pray especially for blessings on all musicians and those who sing to give true praise to the Lord.
At this time of war and conflict in the Holy Land and the Middle East, Sudan, Ukraine, and in so many other places of conflict not in the news, we pray for justice and for peace.
We remember those who have died and those whose anniversaries occur about this time, and we pray that they may rest in the glory and joy of heaven.
The Blessed Virgin Mary magnifies the beauty of divine grace.
We continue to call her blessed and ask her intercession before the Lord.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Media Vita by the 16th century gentleman of the Chapel Royal, John Shepherd. You can hear a full-length version of that anthem on today's Sunday Worship programme page on the Radio 4 website. And there you can also find details of the St. Birinus Festival, where next weekend the Southwell Consort will be singing. Sunday Worship was recorded in St. James Church, Spanish Place, and was led by Father Marcus Holden. The music directors were Will Dawes and Dominic Bevan. The organist was Simon Lewis, and the producer was Philip Bilson. It was a BBC Audio North production for Radio 4. In next week's Sunday Worship, when many Christians remember and pray for the dead, Father Dermot Preston leads a service from the ruins of North Yorkshire's Byland Abbey, a rich source of reflection on saints' souls and spirits. Now on Radio 4, Nocti on America. In the third of four personal essays in the run-up to the presidential election, James Nocti reflects on his decades of travelling and reporting in the US. This week he looks at the conundrum of immigration.
Out of the rain clouds over Ballyporeen in County Tipperary, a president of the United States dropped down for a homecoming, a perfectly choreographed landing for Ronald Reagan. He had traced his great-grandfather back there and his emigration to the New World in the famine years. The president raised a glass in celebration in O'Farrell's bar, more of us watching than the town's whole population. It was 1984, his re-election year. No surprise. If you want to visit O'Farrell's today, though, you have to cross continents. It was dismantled, then reassembled, down to the last gleaming tap in Reagan's presidential library in Simi Valley, California, translated there to complete the story. Reagan was that unusual beast, an ideological warrior with infallible geniality. And one of his legacies, some were divisive and remain so today, was his homely evocation of an American character that somehow transcended, never expunging and instead absorbing its antecedents. He from Ballyporeen, you from a Polish shtetl, she from Napoli, her neighbour from Kiev, but made in America. So how much is hokum, and how much a real alchemy at work? Can you really produce one identity out of the melting pot? After all, Barack Obama calls America's struggle with racial justice its original sin. In 1988, leaving office, Reagan quoted approvingly from a letter he'd received. You can live in Germany, Turkey, or Japan, but you can't become a German, a Turk, or a Japanese, it said. But anyone from any corner of the earth can come live in America and become an American. Reagan thought that defined exceptionalism, a concept embedded in the modern conservative movement of which he remains the rock. Though the idea is not the property of the right, tune into an Obama speech any day. But Reagan's 80s had an air quite different from our chaotic and maybe transitional era. His slogan was, "It's morning again in America." And for him, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses," engraved on the Statue of Liberty, had contemporary power. He often quoted the Puritan sermon from the 1630s, in which John Winthrop saw the Pilgrims' new land in Massachusetts as a shining city on a hill. Unlikely though it may seem now, Reagan introduced an amnesty for undocumented migrant children with one parent legally settled in the US, even if the other wasn't, and about 3 million young people became fully Americanized as a result. A policy that would enrage the current management of his Republican Party, wanting something close to the precise opposite. And his reputation lingered, despite the Iran-Contra scandal and the slew of indictments against those around him, despite environmental and labour policies that infuriated liberals. The lasting image sprang largely from his misty-eyed picture of Americanism, which people had begun to doubt and wanted to recover, imprinting him on the public eye like a grandfatherly figure in a Norman Rockwell painting, swinging gently in his chair in the evening light on the porch. Not by chance. I happened to be on the White House lawn for Reagan's first July the 4th party, thanks to the editor of the Washington Post. Ron and Nancy on tartan rugs, coiffured dogs snuffling in attendance, even Frank Sinatra gazing down on us from the balcony of the South Portico. A reminder that Hollywood had come to town. I was one of the few young men not wearing white chinos and blazer with a Stars and Stripes pin in the lapel. A new conservative establishment was assembled on that stage set. Mind you, there was a more familiar sight just over the high fence down on the mall running from the Lincoln Memorial to the Capitol. The Beach Boys were playing to a vast crowd. The hair was longer, cultures and colours intermingled, no white chinos. Instead, the aroma of illegal substances was wafting across the White House lawn in waves. Two Americas, side by side. The balance has wobbled ever since, and now it tilts sharply. Immigration is as toxic an election issue as abortion. driven by the right as vigorously as freedom for reproductive rights is driven by the liberal left. The southern border, a fiery dividing line. And a symptom of political failure. There have been bipartisan efforts on Capitol Hill over the years to secure it, to deal with drug running and illegal trafficking, and to build an efficient and humane system for those with an asylum case. To welcome as well workers who want to build a productive American life. But the most recent bill was scuppered in the House of Representatives because, according to the Republican leader in the Senate, Donald Trump just didn't want legislation in an election year that might look like a victory for Democrats. For him, the hotter the issue, the better. Last month, I drove along a stretch of the Arizona border, following the famous wall, actually a line of 30-foot-high iron stanchions, an unforgiving place in searing heat up in the 40s, where I met, among others, a cattleman of resolute conservative views in his 80s, twice Arizona Rancher of the Year, who wanted a more secure wall and tougher patrols. He was fed up of armed drug runners on his 50,000 acres spreading north. But he told me he thought most of the people cutting through the fence to start a perilous journey through the scary desert were good people in search of new lives, and he wanted them to make it. A conundrum that everyone in the border states understands, because the economies of Arizona, New Mexico, Texas have depended for generations on undocumented labour. But when the political rhetoric is inflamed, migrants become aliens and nothing but danger. In a nation of immigrants, this is hardly new. In 19th century Boston, the Irish were at the bottom of the heap until they took over. Russians and Poles, even Italians in their day, had to work their passage to find a comfortable dual identity of the kind you'll find if you go to German National Day in Cincinnati or a Polish holiday in Chicago, Columbus Day in Lower Manhattan. Always hard. Think of American Muslims after 9/11. The tensions persist, but the difference today is that disruptive groups once ostracised, like white supremacists, have been emboldened and have more capacity in an online world to recruit. As it's often said these days, Ku Klux Klansmen are taking off their hoods. And when they talk of Christian nationalism, it's not a promise of salvation, but a call to battle. A growing Latino population in particular is to them a direct threat to white America. They rail against identity politics, among others, but not among themselves. Four elections ago, I remember Barack Obama on the eve of polling day, pulling 100,000 people at midnight to a rally in, of all places, Manassas, Virginia, site of the Battle of Bull Run, the first full-scale engagement of the Civil War, in 1861. To see an African-American candidate right there, not far from the capital of the old Confederacy and on the cusp of victory, was to experience a moment that every citizen, hopeful or fearful, knew to be profound. But Obama's election, perhaps like the end of the Cold War, with its hopelessly overblown predictions of a cooperative era of peace, wasn't an end, just another rough beginning. Obama likes to quote Martin Luther King, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." Maybe the most significant word is long. And the way is treacherous. At this moment, an election is working against cooperation across party lines on immigration and against painful but productive efforts at consensus, the unspeakable word. Yet everyone of goodwill across the spectrum knows that, as at the end of almost any war, it has to come, there must be a deal that will last. One nation indivisible, they say in the Pledge of Allegiance in school each morning, affirming their common American identity. The huddled masses will be absorbed, eventually. But the question right now is how much damage will be done in getting there to the principles of their democracy, and perhaps to their precious belief in themselves. Identity politics isn't a phenomenon of the moment. It's as old and awkward as the Republic itself.
Nocte on America was written and presented by James Nocte. The producer was Adele Armstrong. Adam Fleming will be here with Broadcasting House shortly, and then it'll be time for Desert Island Discs. From Buzzy Lee to Gene Pitney via Bach and the Beatles, the world-famous film director Steven Spielberg shares with us the favourite music that's accompanied the personal storyline of his life and career. Desert Island Discs is just after 10. But now, produced by Andrew Dawes and BBC Audio Bristol, Tweet of the Day. The author James Henry finds the Peregrine can inspire his writing.
It was watching Peregrines in Essex that gave me the idea to create a fictional birdwatching detective, and it was a book that caused me to seek these magnificent birds out in the first place. I was a reader long before I was a birder, and it was the discovery of J.A. Baker's 1967 masterpiece, The Peregrine, which first led me to understand that such birds of prey could be found here in Essex. Peregrines are usually associated with the craggy cliffs of northern England, or high buildings within cities such as cathedrals, not the watery East Anglian flatlands where I live. But here they are, winter visitors from autumn through to spring, the period that Baker covered in his book. Baker sought peregrines across the county, yet never named places in his book, as if to protect the birds and keep their whereabouts to himself. However, the anonymous estuary is the Blackwater, near where I live, stretching from Maldon to the North Sea. And I've seen peregrines there during the winter, hunting waterfowl over those same marshes.